Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Action Radio. This is Greg Penglis coming to you from the historic district of downtown Milton on the banks of the beautiful Blackwater River. And now let's get into Action Radio. What, ready? I was still typing. I got stuff to do. We're having so much fun here. Life is a continuum at Action Radio. I mean, I'm on the air, I'm off the air. It never really stops. And so much is happening right now. Like I say, I can't tell you how excited I am about the release, upcoming release, fairly soon, probably, well, certainly by next week, at least I hope so, of our Australian Bill of Individual Rights. And what's so interesting about this is that it clearly states a Bill of Individual Rights. And the reason that is so important is because of the whole idea of collective rights, group rights, special rights, privileges that are the calling rights, entitlements, benefits, and everything else. And we have nothing to do with any of that at all. In fact, I can go over some. I think the first three. I think Jonathan Mosley and I are going to take a look at later on in the show. And so that's going to be good. But the first three really define and set the parameters for what rights are and really set up the remaining rights as to what they have. So it's, as we enumerate rights, the first three really define rights. And that's why those are the most critical and therefore also the most difficult to understand. They're also the newest rights. And, of course, that's going to be very interesting for people to take a look at and go, huh, well, that's interesting. I never thought of that. And that essentially is the whole point. I'd never thought of them either. Until I sat down and Jen sat down, and then we sort of collaborated. That's Jen Clark in Australia. It's fascinating. I just sent her a message earlier. We've never met. You know, we're like half a world away from each other. We got connected by a mutual friend, and we just sort of said, "Well, let's write a Bill of Rights. let's experiment. Let's see what happens." And, well, that was 3 months ago. Now we've got 30 rights. We've got a 45 slideshow presentation. We did a 3-hour Zoom, well, almost 3 hours. Zoom meeting Tuesday night, which is her Wednesday morning, because you know, time difference, international dateline, that kind of stuff. We are both immensely proud of what we've accomplished, and we have absolutely no idea what's going to happen with it. So it could be huge, it could be nothing, it could be somewhere in between. I think huge. I tend to lean towards huge because we're incorporating things like 5G technology, digital tracking, mind-body autonomy, the Nuremberg Code. We're putting things into rights that have never been put into rights because most bills of rights were written anywhere from 250 years ago for our Bill of Rights to maybe 100 years ago. And so none of the technology that exists, I don't think any Bill of Rights in the world, in any government, was written after the advent of the information age. So, in fact, most of them are pre-industrial revolution. So we're talking about, you know, quill pens and manual printing presses, you know, for technology, you know, muskets in terms of bearing arms as opposed to, things we have today. And so it's fascinating to see where this is going to go, because Australia has a national election coming up in May. So that's about 6 weeks. And so releasing this Bill of Rights now is really critical. And I kind of wish we'd done it, you know, several months ago, but the whole process was, we based our entire work on getting this done right, not getting it done fast. And so because of that, it's taken a little bit of time. We used to sit down and write 30 bills of rights. It's not easy. And we took a lot of sources. We took the best of, and there's not much, but the best of the UN Declaration of Human Rights, which seems to pervade most of the bills of rights of the world. And of course, those aren't rights. Those are responsibilities. Those are things that you can't do. And it's also things you're entitled to, you know, from everybody. And so it's a fascinating thing that the UN wrote rights to perpetuate the power of the UN. And so their rights are not rights at all. They're actually government. They're actually international globalist controls under the guise of rights, under the pretense of rights, which aren't rights at all. So we took some of the parts that actually did stay to right, and we left off all the other garbage that went with it. So that was done. We took some of the U.S. Constitution. We took Canadian Constitution, New Zealand Constitution, Australian Constitution. We took a little bit of everything and then wrote our own on top of it. And then we worked it, modernized it, and put it through our own little, intellectual ringer. This is what came out. And so I really do think you're going to find it fascinating. I know I've been talking about it for a while. It's like, well, Greg, when are you going to get to it? When are you going to release it? Well, soon. You know, like I say, Jen did the production. It's her Zoom meeting, her slideshow. And it's her country. So it's really up to her. And that's fine with me. You know, I don't want to, you know, I don't want to play the arrogant American. I know best what's for you. I never went into this with that attitude. I mean, I purposely said, okay, let me see what I can do to help. And I do get carried away. Anybody that knows me, anybody that listens to the show knows that I do get carried away all the time. And so that's always something I have to watch as well. But it's going to be fascinating. And again, this will be, hopefully it'll go to a bunch of folks in this country. It's going to go, hopefully to media, you know, and a lot of different countries, especially through the British Commonwealth, will be writing about this. And people will look at it and go, well, I didn't know we could do that. I didn't know that was a right. You know, I never thought about that. And of course, that's the whole idea. Most of it is education. It's realization. It's action. It's inspiration. And it's going to put the fear in government like you've never seen, especially if it gets ratified. Because the powers that come from this, the statutes that can be written from this, the court cases that can be filed from this and litigated from this are staggering. And that's what makes it so interesting to see what happens. Okay, let's get back to the show today. I've got about 25 minutes before Cindy Cagle gets here in the Medical Freedom Report. And then depending on how long she can stay, I have some time after that. Jonathan Mosley's coming back. He was busy last week. And, you know, I really love our Thursdays with both Cindy and when she can stay and Jonathan, because he has like the back half of the show. And we never have enough time. For those two, it never seems like we have enough time. Thursdays are very special around here. And so it's going to be great to get that going as well. So I thought of something. I'm thinking about the courts and the laws and the fact that we have a basically a racist Marxist, you know, someone who never should have been on the court and probably wouldn't have been if we didn't have geldings in the Republican Party, an absolute Marxist in the Democrat Party. And we actually had a two-party system. You know, we have a one supplicant, subservient, ass kissing. the Republicans aren't a party. They're kind of like, as Claire Lopez used to be on the show, call them the controlled opposition. So the biggest problem with the Supreme Court and the entire judiciary is this idea that they interpret the Constitution. They don't. Because if you interpret something, you change it. Okay. If you interpret one language into another, you know, if you interpret, if you're like an English interpreter and you're English or French to English interpreter, you're going to take French. And if you're going to translate that into English, you're known as an interpreter. So in other words, you're going to change the French meaning to English, but it never transfers exactly because words never have exactly the same meaning. So you've changed it. You've adapted it. You've done something different to it. And of course, depending on how well you translate, how well you interpret the other language to translate is how good a translator and how good an interpreter you are. Well, the same thing happens with the Constitution. If you have judges, justices that are interpreting the Constitution, they're changing it to fit their meaning, which is the only reason you'd want to have a black woman, racist, Marxist on the court, is she's going to, quote, interpret it the way that you want, you know, as opposed to a conservative justice like a black man on the court, in other words, you know, Clarence Thomas, who's not going to interpret the Constitution. He's actually going to read and use it. And so he is the legitimate justice, and the ones who want to interpret it are not and should not be on the court because they are exercising bad behavior and should be removed. So I'm going to be working on in the next little while, probably with Jonathan. I should probably tell him about it. In fact, I'm going to put it in my notes right now. Notes. Let's go. Good behavior oversight. B-H-A-V-I-O-R. Good behavior oversight. And what that is that's a new congressional procedure we're going to write here on the show, whereby Congress will regularly, hopefully every year, review the performance of the Supreme Court justices to measure how much they exhibit good behavior in their judicial opinions, according to Article 3 of the Constitution, which is their document. That's their delegated powers. And if they exceed their delegated powers, that would be bad behavior, and this, of course, should be removed. Now, are we going to set this up so we're judging the quality of their decisions? No. They can make bad decisions and still be in the Constitution. You know, they can exercise really stupid ideas and I wouldn't necessarily call it bad behavior. I call it bad decisions or bad opinions, but bad behavior would constitute interpreting the Constitution, changing the meaning of the Constitution, trying to enforce what they write in their opinions on anything beyond the actual case before them. In other words, the American people. So anybody who voted in the affirmative on Roe v. Wade would have exhibited bad behavior because they tried to make, and actually did make, because so many people believe it, a national policy, whereas the Supreme Court cannot make national policy. The only thing they can do is review and provide opinions on the case before them to settle that dispute. That's what they do. And so they could have settled Roe v. Wade by either ruling for, well, actually either opining for Roe or for Wade and say, well, we find in favor of the plaintiff or the defendant because, and that's it. That's the end of it. That's as far as the case goes. No remedy, no prescription, no law, no regulation, no policy. They can't do that. And so anybody that did would be considered under the oversight procedure, I'm going to write, bad behavior. So we're not removing a free judiciary. We're not, you know, changing what they do, you know, in terms of, getting rid of their independence. What we're doing is we're making them comply with the Constitution, and that's the responsibility of everybody in government anyway. So what's the big deal? All right, let's get on to this other thing I found. So the title of the show today is with no U.S. border, the states must enforce their own borders, all right? And the biggest way that I see to do that is with civil asset forfeiture. As we have discussed many times, illegal aliens have no rights in this country because they can't be here. And I don't care what Supreme Court cases you put before me. I don't care what legislation you put before me. I don't care what statutes or things like that. The truth is that, you know, statutes are bad. All these things can be changed, repealed, abolished, rewritten, whatever. But no matter, because law is never settled. Okay, this idea of settled law is a myth. People do that just so you won't challenge them. All right, but the thing is that illegal aliens have no right to be here. And the simple truth is you cannot have rights in a place that you're not allowed to be in. Why? Because that's irrational. You can't go there, but you've got all your rights and privileges of being there. You know, what? You can't be there, but you can work there. No, you can't. If you can't be there, you can't be there. That's it. That's the end of the argument. That's the end of the discussion. If you can't be there legally, then you're certainly not entitled to anything for the people that can be there legally. Why? Because you cannot be there legally. Okay. Anybody want to challenge me on that? Feel free. I got the live chat open. We've got our Skype line. You can call me from anywhere in the world. You can type from anywhere in the world. You can challenge me. Call up 215-383-3832. If you're a dedicated leftist and you want to talk about it, feel free. You're going to lose, of course, because there's no way to get around the argument. It's impossible. It's impossible to argue for the fact that you can be someplace or that you can have rights in a place that you're not allowed to be in. Why? Because you're not allowed to be there. And nothing will change the fact that you're not allowed to be there unless you change yourself and put yourself in a position where you are allowed to be there. You went to the U.S. consulate. You applied to come into the country. You went through the immigration process. You got yourself a green card. You were invited in. You came here legally, and you came to the United States. That's legal. All these folks that are crossing the border, those aren't migrants. Those are not migrants. They're not immigrants. They're not lawfully allowed to be here. Just because the Brandon insurrection is bringing them in does not make them legal. Does not make them – they have not complied with immigration law. In fact, because the Brandon insurrection is not complying with immigration law, then none of the folks they are bringing in are complying with immigration law. Hence, they have no right to be here and can have what I want to do is civil asset forfeiture. And that would also include against the Brandon insurrection, which has no right to be in the White House. Okay, they have no right to be there either. Well, speaking of the White House, let's do one of my favorite things to do, which is, I haven't done this for a while, which is check on Brandon's schedule. Let's see what the dear boy is up to today. And so we shall, White House, let's see what, we got coronavirus status. Okay, that's fine. There's a cause in that. The president gets his daily brief at 10 o'clock, which would be several hours from now. Okay. What else is it? The president departs the White House for Andrews Air Force Base. And where is he going? North Carolina. Wasn't Trump just there? Trump was just there. What is he going to do in North Carolina? What, go get ice cream? Drool on a porch somewhere? Anyway, then we got 11:30. We got the press secretary is going to lie to us. And then we've got president arrives in Greensboro at 12:20. He's going to visit the Harold L. Martin Senior Engineering Research and Innovation Complex. Oh, he's going to talk to Rhoda to the students who are studying robotics and cybersecurity. Oh, I bet you he's really up on that. What is he going to ask them? You know, who is going to play with the hair of the young students? We'll see what happens. Anyway, so he goes there 2:15. He leaves at 3:30. An hour and 15-minute visit, pretty good. And then he arrives in Maryland. And then he goes to Camp David. So he's already on vacation. So by tonight, he's going to go to North Carolina, meet with people who are doing things he doesn't understand, and then he's going to go to Camp David and take it easy. Tough day. He's got one. He's going to work for an hour and 15 minutes. The rest of the time is just travel, and then he goes to Camp David to sit on the porch, drink lemonade, and watch the sunset. That is your insurrection president, ladies and gentlemen. All right, so a fascinating article came out a while ago, actually, 2011. I've talked about it before, but it's so good and it's so accurate, I want to do it again. It's from the 10th Amendment Center. It's by Bob Greenslade, G-R-E-E-N-S-L-A-D-E, published on December 4th, 2011, talking about state sovereignty. And that category they put in, I don't think that really applies. But anyway, let me read this to you because it's just as current today. Would that be 2022, 11 years later? I'm not good at math. Give me a chance. I'm not good at math. All right, anyway, he says the battle raging between the federal government and the state of Arizona over its so-called anti-immigration law has raised several constitutional issues. It has been asserted by those opposed to the law that the states are precluded from protecting their borders and preventing the influx of illegal aliens because these powers were granted exclusively to the federal government. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, that's a lie. Let me read that again just so you get it. It has been asserted that those opposed to the law, that the states are precluded. Well, I'm not sure what the law is. It was back in 2011. But the idea that the states are precluded from protecting their borders and preventing the influx of illegal aliens because these powers were granted exclusively to the federal government. Lie. And he says, Greenslade says, this assertion is erroneous. It's a lie. Bob, let's use correct language. This assertion is erroneous, he says, because the individual states, as sovereign political entities, have the absolute right to protect their borders from illegal aliens, irrespective of the Constitution or any power granted to the federal government. Well, I would say the Constitution actually grants states the power to control their own borders and keep out illegal aliens. I'll tell you why. 14th Amendment. 14th Amendment is wonderful. It's probably my favorite amendment other than the ones in the Bill of Rights. So let's check out the 14th Amendment, which says, Section 1, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof, which means those who are United States citizens and not citizens of another country. So if you're a citizen of another country, you're subject to the jurisdiction of that country. This is a citizenship jurisdiction, not a geographic one. And once you understand that, you'll understand the 14th Amendment. If you don't understand that, you'll never understand the 14th Amendment. So a citizenship jurisdiction is different than a geographical jurisdiction. That's why illegal aliens born to illegal aliens in this country are not U.S. citizens. They have no birthright here. Why? Because they're subject to the jurisdiction of the country of their citizenship. Those illegal alien children are the citizens of the country of their parents, not of us. So every illegal alien child born in this country to illegal aliens, and that includes Kamala Harris, by the way, which is kind of interesting, the party girl who also stole the White House, are not American citizens. It's just pure and simple, okay? And so what we need to do, and this is going to get really controversial, is we need to go back as far as we can and revoke that citizenship that never should have been given because it's a violation of the 14th Amendment. Oh, but Greg, what are you going to do? That's so cruel. That's so inhuman. How can you do that to those people? Well, simple. They got something they never should have had, okay? Now, would I kick them out of the country? No. I would work out some kind of permanent status, but you've got to revoke as far back through the chain migration as you can. Everybody that was illegally given the privilege of citizenship, you need to revoke all of them as far back as you can go, as far back as the computer records can go, and stop that chain. Revoke that chain. Stop anything. You want to protect your borders? This is how you do it. The states actually could probably do that too. It's kind of an interesting concept that if the states revoke, the state citizenship, those people become persona non grata. They cannot stay in the state. Maybe something to work on. Let's write that down. This is how we do things on the show. This is how my brain works, right? So let's call it state revocation of illegal birthright citizenship. It's not birthright. Illegal. What should we call it? It's called geographic birth citizenship. I wish I could write faster. Geographic. Because I make it geographic as opposed to citizenship, right? This is supposed to be a citizenship. Geographic birth citizenship. Citizenship. Okay. I shouldn't try to write and talk at the same time. All right. I've only read the first couple of lines of the article. So anyway, let me get back to the 14th Amendment. All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. Think about that. Everybody in the United States is a dual citizen of both the United States. We're talking legal American citizens. If you're an American citizen born here or naturalized, okay, you are a citizen of the United States and of the state in which you reside. That is a dual citizenship, which means if you're not a citizen of the United States, if you're not either naturalized or born here, okay, you are not a citizen of the state in which you reside. Okay. Well, if you're not a citizen of the state in which you reside, the state can protect, the rest of the citizens from you. They can kick you out. Think about that. Okay. So all persons born naturally to the United States, that would also include, legal permanent residents. That would include people on a tourist visa. A work visa, tourist visa, things like that. So if you're legally in the country, you can't be kicked out of your state either. I would argue that, even though that's not specifically in the Constitution. But what is in the Constitution is if you are not a citizen of the United States, you are not a citizen of the state in which you reside. And if you're in the United States illegally, you have no business being there. The states can use the 14th Amendment to say, look, these people aren't citizens of the United States. They're not citizens of the state in which they are residing. Get the hell out. And they can be thrown out because they have no business being in the United States because they can't legally be here. So an illegal alien in any state can be removed from that state. Now, can the state, deport outside the country? I don't know. That might be an interesting question to talk about. But a state can certainly deport outside their state. So if we divide the country into states which is illegal alien sanctuaries, California, Michigan, Wisconsin, New York, all the leftists, Oregon, Washington, all the leftist states, and we have states that are American citizens and legal residents, legal permanent residents only, Florida, Texas, South Carolina, Wyoming. I'm just making up states right now. South Dakota, places like that. Then you're not going to have illegal aliens there. So the illegal aliens need to be forced into the states that want them. And then the federal government has to cut off money for illegal aliens and make the states pay for them. This is how you do it. I mean, there are ways to do these things. The solutions are easy. The willpower to do them is not. This is really what it comes down to. So back to this article here. This assertion is erroneous because the individual states are sovereign political entities, have the absolute right to protect their borders from illegal aliens, irrespective of the Constitution or any power granted to the federal government. Well, I would say I would just stop at the states have an absolute right to protect their borders, okay, because they are sovereign political entities. I'm not sure why the qualifier, but let's continue with the article. Greenslade says, we are constantly told that people illegally entering the country are undocumented immigrants and that the federal government has the jurisdiction over all matters concerning immigration. This is not the case. In fact, the word immigration does not appear in the Constitution. Oh boy, did you know that? Okay. The only general power granted to the federal government concerning aliens, and I would say illegal aliens particularly, in times of peace is the power, quote, to establish a uniform rule of naturalization. In other words, the process of becoming a citizen, all right? This provision was inserted because there was, in the words of James Madison, a dissimilarity in the rules of naturalization among the states. So the states were making, I guess, state citizens. So in other words, if you immigrated to North Carolina in the 1700s, you would be a citizen of North Carolina, and the rules for becoming a citizen of the United States were whatever North Carolina said. Okay, that's crazy. There are certain things that you can't have different rules. See, the whole point of the Constitution is to make certain standards. One of those standards is naturalization. Other standards, weights and measures, time, like central daylight, East Coast time, West Coast time, things like that. Tariff rules, money. Money was a thing that had to be standardized. You couldn't have, South Carolina dollars mixing with Nebraska dollars at different values. That made no sense. So that's why we have U.S. dollars until the Federal Reserve, and that's unconstitutional too, but that's another show. So anyway, so the whole point of this is to have uniform rules of naturalization, not illegal aliens, not anything else, but citizenship. Okay. So the states aren't, so you don't have 50 different procedures for becoming a United States citizen. And that makes sense. Okay. Anyway, article says this provision was inserted because there was, by vesting this power in the federal government as opposed to the individual states, the founders ensured that the qualifications for becoming a citizen would be uniform throughout the several states. If the rule were not uniform, one state could impose a different standard than another or discriminate against immigrants from certain nations. No other power is granted to the federal government concerning the subject. Okay, so that's the point. The point is that we wanted uniform rules of immigration, of naturalization, not immigration. We wanted uniform rules of naturalization. In other words, the process of becoming a citizen. Okay, but it says no other power is granted to the federal government concerning the subject. So the idea that the federal government can control the borders, they can with the military. They can keep people out there. We have border patrol and things like that. I believe that, maybe I'm going to get myself in trouble here, but I believe that the federal government does control the borders, or not, as the case may be these days. But they certainly don't control the state borders, okay? And they certainly don't control immigration. They control naturalization. That's why the law is the rule. Is it the Immigration and Naturalization Act? I'll have to take a look. Or is it the Citizenship and Naturalization Act? I'll have to take a look at that. But anyway, I don't think the word immigration is there. Federal government, the only thing that the Constitution says about any of this is naturalization. It does not grant exclusive authority on immigration to the federal government. It's just very simple. The Constitution doesn't do that. All right. So it says, article says, the federal government also claims the duty of securing the borders of these United States. I like the term these United States, not the United States. It's not the, it's these. Because the states are separate political entities and sovereignties, okay? So I'm going to start saying that more often just in case. It's not a joke. It actually is a legal term. Anyway, so wait a minute. Did I scroll down too far? Okay, I lost my place. I hate when that happens. I was on a roll, too. Where'd it go? The federal government can claim where are my these? See, I said these, and I got so carried away with what I was talking about. Now I've lost my place. How did I lose my place? I was in a good spot. All right, wait a minute. Let me just back up a little bit. Yeah, I really feel silly here. Sorry, I'll be with you in just a second. I must have scrolled too far. Okay. This is not the case. I must have skipped down. I'm going to go back a little bit. now that I feel totally embarrassed here, I can't believe I lost my place. All right, so okay, I said that. There was, in fact, no federal government. Okay, I already said that. All right. The federal government also claims, there we go, I think I'm in the right place. We'll find out in a second. The federal government also claims the duty of securing the borders of these, there it is, of these United States rests solely with the federal government. The Constitution states, the United States shall guarantee to every state in this union a republican form of government and shall protect each of them against invasion. Well, we talked about the republican form of government, certainly not a coup d'etat, certainly not a Marxist form of government we have now, but the Constitution requires the federal government to maintain a republic, not a democracy. That's something we should talk about too, and then we have, and we're going to again. But the key phrase here is that it says, the United States shall guarantee to every state in this union a republican form of government and shall protect each of them against invasion. Well, what that means is that when the Brandon insurrection is actually causing an invasion by bringing in illegal aliens, they are not only they're violating the Constitution, not only for not doing what they're supposed to do, but doing something that's completely illegal. In other words, facilitating the invasion of illegal aliens into our country. Okay, it says if aliens entering into a state from a foreign country constitute, quote, an invasion, then the federal government is constitutionally mandated by this provision to intervene and protect the state. Exactly. So in other words, the feds have to get rid of illegal aliens in every state. We have the right, believe it or not, to a nation free of illegal aliens. Think about that. We have a right to be free of illegal aliens. And the Constitution mandates that the federal government create that for us by getting rid of illegal aliens. You know, it's intolerable. Any illegal alien in the country is a violation of the Constitution because of the duty to prevent invasions, you know, foreign invaders from staying in our country. It's just that simple. That's kind of fascinating. You never hear that brought up in the news, right? Back to the article. I know where I am now. The Constitution grants the federal government the power to fulfill this duty in one of two ways. It can either use the military or Congress can call forth the militias of the several states to repel the invasion. Congress can put the military on the border. Okay, Congress can put the military on the border. Congress, put the military on the border. What the hell's wrong with you people? Well, the geldings, right? You got geldings and Marxists. And they like the deep state better than they want America first. It's just that simple. They believe in the deep state. They believe in the globalist model. They don't want America first. They don't. And that's the problem, too. Back to this here. Article 1, Section 8, Clause 15. Once Congress calls forth the militia, the president, as commander-in-chief, has the power to direct the movement of these forces. Thus, the president could constitutionally send the state militias to any state to repel the invasion by illegal aliens. However, if illegal aliens pouring into the states do not constitute an invasion, then the federal government lacks the constitutional authority to intervene and prevent the states from protecting their borders. Yeah, but that doesn't mean the states can't protect themselves. And that's what we get into. It says, note, the National Guard is a state military force, and it's referred to as the organized militia. The so-called common folk who meet certain requirements are referred to as the unorganized militia. There is no federal militia. Let me say that again. There's no federal militia. So the federal government can't call into service the federal militia because there ain't one. They got a military. That's different, but that's not a militia. And that is the difference. You know, militia and military are completely different organizations with different laws, different rules, different everything. You know, Second Amendment, you know, a well-regulated militia being necessary to a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. Okay. People forget that part, that a well-regulated militia is necessary to our freedom. It's necessary to a free state. I would say both geographically and conditionally. Right? Geographically, because you know the state of Florida should be able to remain free by using the state militia to repel the invasion that the Brandon Horde is bringing. Conditionally, our freedom, the state of being free, you know, as a condition of our life, is also dependent on our ability to keep and bear arms. So both the state geographically and the state as a condition of our freedom are both essential. All right, almost done here, and then we'll get to Cindy. There is no specific provision in the Constitution for the so-called Border Patrol to function within the several states. Protecting the borders of the states from illegal aliens has nothing to do with the federal government's power to establish a uniform rule of naturalization. The regular military and the militia are the only entities designated in the Constitution, slow down, Greg, to protect the states from invasion. So we have our state militia. And we have the regular military. So the military and the state militias can protect us, okay, from this illegal alien invasion. Now, I would add to that civil asset forfeiture, okay? Civil asset forfeiture is the ability to take the property of anybody engaged in a criminal enterprise. And I'll take this more up and later in the show, especially when we get to Jonathan here in an hour. But anybody that is in the country illegally, okay, is committing the crime of being in the country illegally every day they are here, that is a repeat offense. So if someone's here for 10 years, you're talking about 3,650 individual serial crimes against this nation. I think that constitutes a repeat offender. Okay. So every day that somebody's in the country, they wake up and they say, I'm going to stay in the United States illegally. That is a crime. And because of that, every asset of theirs can be seized. Every asset of every company that hires them can be seized. Every asset of the Catholic, Lutheran, Baptist charities that facilitated their arrival here can be seized. Every group, every organization, every everything that contributes or in any way aids and abets an illegal alien staying in the country, their assets can be seized. That's how you get rid of illegal aliens, because you make it intolerable and impossible for them to live here. They will run out of this country. And when they run out of this country, and those that can't run out of this country will happily provide transportation back to their home country, the country of their jurisdiction, the country responsible for them, and they can have a wonderful time in their own country, and then we can work on making those countries more free and more prosperous, as we talked about with Estonia the other day. But I do digress. Let's get to Cindy Cagle and the Medical Freedom Report. Informed consent, the ability to receive the truth for your medical care, and the ability to consent freely to any medical procedure, or not, based on the truthful information received, has completely disappeared in this era of medical, big government, big tech, big pharma, fascism. There are many warriors coming forward to try and keep your medical freedom. This is so you won't be forced to ever wear a mask, and you won't be forced through a government mandate to inject your body with a dangerous experimental gene therapy purposely and deceitfully called a vaccine. Medical freedom is when you aren't forced into anything that violates your individual rights. Join us now as one of those warriors of medical freedom talks about the latest victories and the struggles yet to be won. Join us now for the Medical Freedom Report with Cindy Cagle. And just before I get to Cindy, we're getting a little bit of an echo on this line, so I'm guessing Cindy has a phone near a computer or a computer near a phone or something. We need to mute something to end the echo. It happens. There we go. Okay. So, Cindy, how about that storm last night? Isn't it nice to be in Florida? Wasn't that fun?
I slept through it.
Oh, you missed a great storm. Now, normally I sleep through them, too. When I say I can sleep through hurricanes, I'm not kidding. I mean, I woke up and Sally was raging. I went, oh, there's a hurricane. That's interesting. You know.
And so normally I don't. So
oh,
I heard just the very beginning of it, and then
oh, wow.
I was out.
Yeah. Well, we got stormy weather. We've got blizzards in half the country, and we've got the heat wave in the other half. This is a fascinating time.
Oh,
so,
that's awesome.
It is awesome. Yeah, yeah, yeah. So medical freedom, what's going on in the world? And then I want to talk to you about the Gates. Both Cindy and I went to different Gates events, Gates and Green, Marjorie Taylor Greene and Matt Gaetz events last Saturday. So I'm kind of curious what happened up in Milton. And I'll tell you what happened in Crestview. But anyway, medical freedom, where anything on the forefront, anything on the cutting edge, anything really important right now, other than the mask mandate was extended by Dr. Fascist?
Yes.
Can you say his title? Can you say his full title? Or should we practice?
Dr.
A genocidal, psychopathic, narcissistic, avaricious, pathologically lying vaccine drug pusher.
That's him.
With
a lot
really
of control and power.
Yeah, yeah. Yep.
Do
tell.
You know, I am not aware at the moment of anything new and exciting on the medical freedom front, except, you know, the asinine decision to extend the mask mandate on transportation. I know from our position, we're working on a candidate questionnaire for elected officials or people running for elected positions in the 2022 race.
Oh, can I help?
From
a
medical
freedom
standpoint.
Can I help? Hands up. Hands up. My hand is raised. Can I help? Please, please, please. Can I help?
Sure.
I'll give you some questions that'll blow their minds.
We're at 15 right now, and you know.
Well, let's hear some. Can you release this at this point? Can you tell us some of the things you're asking, or do you want to hold that back? Up to you.
Let's hold off until we finalize it. We're getting input from, you know, several fronts, but a lot of a lot of voters have questions, and we feel like we should use our voice to help get answers to those questions, especially in the climate now. We're no longer just going to vote for someone because they have the right letter next to their name.
You know, on this
that
show,
isn't
I'm
working out so well.
You know, I talk about the Democrat Marxists and the GOP geldings. You know, I don't stand with either party. I have no use for either one. And you folks that don't know what gelding means, look it up. Okay, it's the only way I could put something that seemed appropriate with using the letters GOP to create the acronym here. Well, let me make up a question anyway, just for the fun of it. Don't tell me the questions you have, but
okay.
let me see if I can throw one out there for you. So we're looking at, so at candidates, is it based on medical freedom or what's your criteria?
Yeah, ours is. Now, there's been interest expressed to do this for several of the other key issues, you know, our country's facing, and particularly our area, CRT, gender equality, what were some of the other, teachers union. I thought that was a really good one.
Okay, so this isn't strictly medical. You're actually bringing some other things.
The one that Citizens for Medical Freedom is doing is geared towards medical freedom, but we're now kind of expanding out to some other groups that have a broader scope of fight, and thinking that we might, you know, include those topics.
Okay, so are you sponsoring
different groups?
Are you sponsoring the questionnaire, or are you part of another, like an umbrella group kind of thing? How's it working?
Citizens for Medical Freedom is going to sponsor the medical freedom questionnaire, and then we're actually, my husband is reaching out to some of the other groups that, like I said, fight on a broader scale, to see if maybe they would sponsor some other topics.
Okay, I get two questions immediately. You got your pen?
Sure.
Or you can check the podcast later. The first one is, do you believe in using civil asset forfeiture to remove the property of illegal aliens to make it impossible for them to live in the United States? That's my first question.
That is a good one.
Yeah. Well, I try. And you can write in short form, but do you believe in civil asset forfeiture to make it impossible? And you might have to explain what that is to some of the politicians that have no clue what the law is, which is why they're running probably. But and I'm happy. I have a bill. I have a bill. I have several bills, in fact. I got a couple of them here. In fact, what I'll do right now, because I had this on deck just in case I needed it, I wrote a bill for Santa Rosa County. And so we are in Santa Rosa County, Florida. We are the second to the last county before you get to Alabama, on the northwest corner, the upper left part of Florida. And I wrote a bill for Santa Rosa County commissioners such that they could create an illegal alien-free zone right here in Santa Rosa County. And, of course, every other county in Florida could model this. And they could then take that, it could also go nationwide. Well, guess what the Santa Rosa County commissioners have done with this bill?
Nothing.
You said it all in one word. Nothing. Exactly. They've done nothing. They don't talk about it. I've talked to them individually. I've talked to a couple of folks, James Calkins and what's his name, Peach. You know that dude. Met him at a place where I was giving a speech before they kicked me off the stage. That's kind of an interesting story too. I'm getting all the dirt out today. I'm in a mood. All right. So, but think about that. It would cost them nothing to implement this. It would benefit all the citizens of Santa Rosa County because all the proceeds that are confiscated from illegal aliens because they're not allowed to be here would be that when the goods are sold, that money comes back to Santa Rosa County taxpayers.
And what's the response on it privately?
I don't think any of them have actually read it. You know, part of the problem is the citizens of Santa Rosa have not put it to them. But I certainly have. I've released press releases. I've posted on Facebook. I've talked to all kinds of folks. You know, it's just people don't want it. In other words, they're happier to complain about illegal aliens than they are to actually do something positive that would make it impossible for them to live here and wouldn't cost anything. This is a self-funding program, really. Hmm. You know, just legally you do it by – go ahead. Yeah.
I was going to ask, are you assuming that citizens of Santa Rosa don't want it or by their inaction or – have people given a counter-argument to it?
Well, the counter-argument is the Supreme Court, in some of their bogus rulings, says that illegal aliens are allowed to be here and they have to be educated in the schools and other things. Those decisions are unconstitutional. Those are the standard arguments I get. But quite frankly, the media hasn't covered it. Our local Santa Rosa Press Gazette hasn't covered it. What I'm calling the partial news journal, the Pensacola News Journal, doesn't cover it. You know, the Northwest Florida Daily, that's now a Gannett newspaper. That's one thing I learned from Matt Gaetz, that our regional media is now national. They're not covering it. So it's not being covered. They're not considering it. And so we need to make
a part of me that says, you know, they have solutions. They just don't want to fix things.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know
Agreed.
If that's because it puts them out of a job or it stops a financial incentive.
This would probably keep them in office for life. if they pass civil asset forfeiture for illegal aliens, they'd be the most, especially when the assets were sold and the money was returned to Santa Rosa taxpayers. How could they not want that? What kind of morons do we have on the Board of County Commissioners? Well, I know what kind of morons. I've met them. Hey, you guys want to challenge me? Call me up, 215-383-3832. This is an open forum. Even if you're a moron, you know, on the Board of County Commissioners, you can call up this show. Why you don't want to do anything about illegal aliens, given the fact that Brandon is flying these people around the country and dropping them off largely in Florida. I mean, this is irrational not to do something about this. And it's going to get twice as bad when Title 42. Well, can you explain, this is kind of your department, maybe sort of. Everybody says that Title 42 is being repealed. Title 42 is not being repealed. Title 42 covers the entire public health administration of the entire federal government. They're not repealing that. They're repealing one small section of it, and I don't know where that is. Is that something you've taken a look at?
I'm sorry to be ignorant, but I don't know what Title 42 is.
Oh, okay. Title 42 is the entire public health administration of the entire federal government. Yeah. That's really interesting because they keep mentioning it on the news, that which raises the question is, do the journalists know when they say we're going to repeal Title 42? Do they have a clue what they're talking about?
I don't know that I've heard it. If I have, I haven't paid any attention to it, which is
okay. That's why you're such a great bellwether. you tell me exactly what good old regular American folks are thinking, and then I say, oh, okay, well, I guess I better do something about that.
Yeah, now I've got to look into that because I'm not aware of it. So they're trying to repeal what about it?
All right, so Title 42, there is a provision that allowed the Trump administration to block illegal aliens coming in if they weren't healthy. In other words,
oh,
and this
okay.
is and this has been going on for a long time. Ellis Island. You know, everybody knows Ellis Island, where the Europeans came to immigrate to the United States, right? Ellis Island,
yeah.
New York Harbor. Okay, that was essentially a quarantine station. The reason that prospective American citizens, sorry, let me rephrase that. The reason that legal immigrants, lawful people, came to Ellis Island before being released into the United States was because they wanted to make sure that they were releasing people into the United States that were healthy and were not bringing communicable diseases. So Ellis Island, just like Angel Island on the West Coast for Asian immigrants, Ellis Island for European immigrants was a quarantine station. That's why it's put on an island. So people would be on the island. They wouldn't spread a disease beyond the island. It was a quarantine. Okay. So the borders are quarantine zones. And if somebody is unhealthy, if they have a communicable disease, tuberculosis, measles, AIDS, who knows what they have, you know, things like that, you can be denied entry to the United States until you meet certain health criteria. So what the Brandon insurrection, what the illegal coup, what the non-border folks are doing is that they're waiving that or ignoring it or repealing that provision or putting an executive order that doesn't apply. In other words, they're making law by not enforcing law that they're constitutionally bound to enforce, and they're saying we don't care about the healthiness of illegal aliens. So while the mask extension for American citizens, who have no rights apparently in this country, was extended, the rights were actually granted to illegal aliens who have no rights in this country. Everything's backwards. It's fascinating, right? To be able to come into this country without a health check. Yeah. So illegal aliens,
and
no
then
health
you,
check. Go ahead.
And you have special forces being threatened and disciplined because they're not vaccinated to be kicked out of the military.
How about
that? It makes absolutely no sense. But we're going to cart illegal aliens with unknown medical status around the United States.
Mm-hmm. At taxpayer expense.
And give them,
giving them cell phones, free health care.
How much sense does that make?
Well, it does if you're trying to create a peasant class of dependents that can outvote American citizens. That's what this is all about. This is about changing the demographics of this country, making us a peasant nation of subservient dependents so the Democrats can remain in power forever. Why the geldings are allowing this is because they don't care. As long as they can be losers and be comfortable in their positions, you know, and their perks and they get their benefits and salary and retirement, they don't care that the country's going to be completely lost. Doesn't bother them. This is why I can't stand the parties. I would make it illegal for anybody to serve in any legislature as a member of a party. I would say that you have to be independent. And that would at least start to remove some of this problem where you've got Marxists running the country and subservient, supplicant, you know, geldings going along with it, you know, faking opposition. I'm going to look up supplicant. That sounds like a great word. Sometimes you use words and I go, does that really apply? Let's find out. So while you were commenting, I will look up the word that I used to make sure that I actually used it correctly.
Well, yeah. And speaking of which, we met a group of those special forces, Air Force active duty service members that are, you know, facing those consequences of discipline to include being kicked out and their benefits taken. These are the best of the best in our military, obviously healthy, and you're going to punish them for not taking a vaccine, yet you've got unknown health status. Unknown health status of illegals being carted around the country. That in itself should shock the conscience of every American.
Well, it's worse than that. I mean, you're absolutely right on. But I think it's worse because the snake oil jab, and if you see the latest video by Dr. Artis that's circulating, which you can't post on Facebook, he's talking about, you know, all kinds of amazing stuff from that jab. You know, everything from DNA from snake venom to a bunch of other things. So when I call it snake oil, you know, I had no idea, but I was actually, you know, right. You know, this thing may actually be, you know, part snake oil as opposed to a bat virus and all the other stuff, or a pangolin. It almost sounds like pangolin, my name. But anyway, I found that kind of funny. So if I get called the pangolin talk show, so you'll know why. So I don't think most people know what that is. But think about that for a second, that what we used to call a fake good, and this is before product labeling, and standards and the Federal Trade Commission, FDA, and things like that. You know, you could bottle anything. You know, you could bottle, you know, horse poop, you know, fill it with water and call it snake oil or call it medicine. You know, I mean, this is what people are doing. There's anything to sell, right? Because this is back in the bad old days in the 1800s. There's no product regulation. So some regulation is actually a good thing. So you don't get horse poop in a bottle with water and it's called medicine. You know, I mean, there are reasons why we have product safety, and that's why. But the euphemism was snake oil. And anybody who was, you know, a proprietor, you know, pervading this stuff out onto the market, that they had no idea what it was. They didn't know what it did. And making all these ridiculous false claims. This will cure anything. You know, that was called snake oil. Because that was some, I guess that was one of the terms they were using. And now it really applies to what I call the snake oil jab. In other words, they're making all these false claims. They're saying it's safe and effective. It's closely monitored. It's all this other kind of crap. And yet you've got especially soccer players, which are some of the healthiest people in the world and one of the most stressful sports in the world on your heart, dropping dead. So you can't tell me this is safe. It's certainly effective, but not the way they intended. So why would you take special forces people who are allegedly also the healthiest people on the planet, and probably are, which have the most physical strain of probably anybody? I mean, they practically starve those people to death. They're actually, you know, their training is so extreme, they're actually, you know, burning muscle. They have to actually rebuild themselves after the ordeal they go through. It's really unbelievable. You know, can you imagine getting now we haven't heard any deaths of or have we had deaths of trainees or special forces people, you know, suspicious deaths? You know, anything they call natural causes or a training accident or something like that. Do you have any records of those in the special forces?
Well, I don't know about deaths, and I don't know if it's specific to special forces, but there has been, you know, whistleblower reports that injuries or health concerns have skyrocketed for military personnel after getting vaccinated.
Mm-hmm.
So there's definitely consequences from it, and they're not good. I forget the name of the military doctor that came out and wanted to ground all the pilots,
mm-hmm.
Because of you know, heart conditions and the possibility of having an event up in the air, you know, while they're flying.
Well, yeah, they're flying multi-million-dollar supersonic aircraft very close to each other. What can go wrong with a heart attack, right? I mean, that's insane. Well, pilots have a special situation medically, and this is something you might want to look into with the group as well. Pilots undergo something that most other soldiers don't undergo, sailors or anybody else, and that's G-forces, okay? Mm-hmm. G-forces put a strain on your heart. Why? Because it pulls blood from your brain that your heart has to work 10 times harder to put back. That's why people black out when you pull too many G's. They found this out in World War II, that the airplanes could turn tighter than the pilots could stand. So when they start pulling G's beyond like 6 or 7 or 8, depending on how good and how young and how healthy the pilot was, and how much blood they could stand losing from their brain, they gray out, then they black out. You get the tunnel vision, and then you literally pass out. And this is how a lot of pilots were killed, because they would turn too tight, they would black out, and the enemy would just shoot them down. Either we shoot them down or they shoot us down. And, you know, because of blackout. And so this is why it's so critical to have healthy pilots, because they can black out. Now they have G suits now, which squish your thighs and pump your blood back up and don't let it drain to the bottom of your feet, you know, hopefully keeping it closer to your heart and brain. But try to imagine the stress on your body and on your heart if you're in, say, let's say, let's sort of maximum. Most of the planes are stressed for 7 Gs. So 7 times your body weight. So you've got a 180-pound pilot. Well, let's do easy math. 200-pound pilot at 7 Gs. 7 Gs are 14. That's 1,400 pounds of pressure. So the pilot's body now weighs 1,400 pounds. So the heart now has to pump, instead of a 200-pound pilot, under 1G. We live in 1G right now. We're experiencing one force of gravity. Obviously, otherwise we'd fly off the planet and all kinds of other things would happen. That's for a different show. We're all experiencing 1G, okay? And so when you go to 7Gs, your body effectively weighs 7 times as much. There's 7 times the gravitational pull on your body, 7 times the force pulling, you know, blood out of your brain. Well, that's got to put a stress on your heart, right?
Makes sense, yeah.
So when's the most likely time for a vaccine-injured, a snake-oil-jabbed person to have a heart attack? 1G or 7Gs? This is a rhetorical question, of course.
Yeah, logic tells me it's 7.
Yeah, okay. That's the first problem. Let me document the second. Oh, let me interrupt for a second. I looked up supplicant. Adjective, making or expressing a plea. That sounds like the Republicans, especially to someone in power. Yeah, that sounds like the Democrats or authority. Yeah, that sounds like what they think they are. A supplicant serf before an ill-tempered monarch. So I'm right. The GOP geldings are actually supplicants. Noun, a person making a humble or earnest plea to someone in power or authority. We are equals and not supplicants begging for work. No, you're supplicants begging for work. And this is my favorite. This is my online dictionary. This is why I love looking things up, right? Because I can just see this is what Mitch McConnell does every day to Chuck Schumer. Not literally, but certainly figuratively. Supplicants prostrate themselves on the floor. So, you know, we need a cartoon. I need to contact Ben Garrison, who's a friend of mine. He does these amazing cartoons. I'll have to have Mitch McConnell prostrating himself before Chuck Schumer. Oh, please let me do something. Please let me have some authority. Please, please, please. Even when he had the majority. There's your image for today. Supplicants. I need to use that word again. Supplicants. Yeah, supplicants.
I don't want to be a supplicant.
You're not a supplicant. Do you prostrate yourself on the floor in front of Chuck Schumer?
No, I don't. No.
Yeah, exactly. Don't worry about it. You're a leader.
Gets me in trouble.
Cindy Cagle is a warrior.
No, like just a mom with a big mouth.
Warrior. Warrior. You're a warrior. I'm going to give you another round of applause while I'm at it. So don't judge yourself. Yeah, anyway. So that's the first problem with pilots. The second problem with pilots is the air. Most people do not know this, but the reason that people have problems, if they have a drink, they get knocked out faster than on the ground, because the air in the cabins of airliners, and I think military jets to a lesser extent, because they have to wear the masks to pump air into their lungs, okay? So military jets are pressurized even less than civilian planes, because if a military jet gets the canopy blown off, which is something rather likely in combat, they have to have the oxygen, and they wear the masks. And the oxygen mask and the visors and the goggles, so that if the canopy is blown off, they can still fly out of the airplane. And so that's what that. But here's what people don't know: those cabins are pressurized to 8,000 feet. That's like a mile and a third. That's actually over a mile and a third. It's like a mile and 3/5. So what that means is it's Denver air plus 3,000 feet. Okay, The air is much thinner. It's about 85% oxygen compared to 100% at sea level. So you're losing 15% of your oxygen. You know, now let's combine that with masks. Masks reduce your oxygen too. So not only do you have this unconstitutional mask wearing that's going on in airliners, they're actually reducing, just because that's the way the airliners work, because it's too expensive to pressurize them to sea level, so they pressurize them to 8,000 feet. That's why you sleep so well, because you're oxygen deprived. Everybody on an airline, including the pilots, are oxygen deprived because this is true. They're all, unless they're wearing oxygen, which they don't, they sit there bright and smiling with their faces. This is your captain speaking. Today I'm going to be oxygen deprived as I suffer with you at an 8,000 foot cabin. So that's cabin pressure. Now let's put that in the military. So let's go into combat. Okay. Let's go into extreme oxygen situations. Remember when Goose and Top Gun was breathing heavily? And then they'll pop open the mask, which is stupid. You want to keep the mask on because that's what's giving you the oxygen, you idiots. I don't know who made that film. Anyway, the new Top Gun's coming out, but I digress. But the point is that, they are oxygen deprived. And so you combine G-forces, oxygen deprivation, and a vaccine injury that causes heart swelling, myocarditis, and heart attack. You put that all together with a combat pilot? That's a recipe for death. And yet they're requiring it to stay healthy. The military is required to do that to, quote, maintain readiness and stay healthy. That's Orwellian. Back to you, Cindy.
Yeah. Well, the irony, too, my husband wasn't a jet pilot. He was a helo pilot. But for, you know, the 26 years of his career, if he took really anything other than a Motrin, he was grounded. Mm-hmm. They weren't allowed to fly. Mm-hmm. So the change in thought process has has been remarkable to give an experimental use vaccine to a bunch of pilots and think that, you know, there's no reason to be cautious.
Now, that's an excellent point, because we did the same thing when I was a flight instructor, a civilian flight instructor. You know, we had this thing, I'm safe. It was a little acronym. I think it's illness, medication, stress, emotion. I forgot what F standard for, E stood for. But anyway, the thing is, you can't go out medicated. You know, we have a rule that they say eight hours from bottle to throttle. In other words, you can't go up if you had a drink within 8 hours. But the real rule is, you can't go up if you're still under the influence of a drink, no matter how many hours ago it was. All right. Mm-hmm. If you're fatigued, or the F is fatigue. Okay. If you're tired, you're not allowed to fly. Really. I mean, anything that would impair your ability to fly an airplane. And I see this too. And unfortunately, I was young and healthy. I was in my early 30s when I did it, when I was a flight instructor. And I may do it again. I'm getting healthier again. Losing weight. Yes. Oh, I'm going to be a terror of the skies once again. That was going to be fun. I want my jet. Action Radio 1, we're going to have a jet. I'll take Mike up. I'll take your husband up, and we'll look.
Oh, awesome.
And we'll take you up, too. See what you do upside down.
Puke.
Goose, it's time to buzz the tower. By the way, I don't buzz the tower. I'd lose my license. I'm not stupid. You know. Anyway, but point being that you got to be healthy. And, you know, this one, getting the weight down, so I'll be in flying shape.
The military was extremely, I mean, almost overly cautious.
Mm-hmm.
When you're taking something like an allergy medicine and being grounded, or an antibiotic,
mm-hmm.
So it really, the thought process has done a 180
give
them this vaccine, and then
not necessarily. Think back to the Gulf War. Think back to the anthrax vaccine. Think back to the chemical that we all suspected of causing Gulf War syndrome was something called squalene, S-Q-U-A-L-E-N-E. I know this because I did huge reports on it back at WBY. I spent a week on squalene because of another vaccine that the military wanted to bring in. Military and the government have a history of forcibly injecting soldiers, sailors, and airmen and women simply because they can, actually they want to sell the product or for whatever reason. But squalene is something you should look up. It's called an adjuvant, A-D-J-U-V-A-N-T.
V-A-N-T.
An adjuvant is like a booster. You know, in other words, it takes a regular, you know, so-called vaccine, and it's like steroids. It boosts its potential without spending a lot of money. And so squalene's in the flu shot. Are you folks getting the flu shot? No, you want you to think about that. Look up squalene, S-Q-U-A-L-E-N-E. So it's suspected of giving Gulf War syndrome. So what do you think it's doing to seniors if it's in the flu shot? Okay. So all those people that think might be victims of COVID, you might be victims of a flu shot. Now let's combine a flu shot with a COVID shot, both of which may contain squalene.
Huh.
Oh, interesting, huh?
Yeah. Boy, I've got some work to do. That's another first for me. But, you know, in all honesty, I wasn't really involved in – I was of the mentality that if the government's doing it, it's for the well-being of, you know, the country and most Americans. COVID did. I'm ashamed to say that I really was not engaged, and I was very trusting.
Mm-hmm.
I know my husband and I have talked about the anthrax vaccine, and it was there were complications with it, and I don't know if they were if they stopped it, or there was something that came out of it to protect soldiers. And I don't remember what that is. I'll have to ask him. But, you know, it was treated differently than the COVID vaccine in a much earlier time frame. We're, you know, 2 years into this, almost 2 years into these vaccines, and they're showing no signs of accepting, you know, the truth that there are complications and even deadly complications with these vaccines. They seem to be pushing forward and kicking very qualified soldiers out of the military for it.
Oh, no, it's insane what's going on. While we were talking, I was looking up, I put a little thing in the search engine, Gulf War anthrax vaccine and COVID vaccine. And guess what came up? The Army Times. And it says this is Todd South, June 17th, 2021. So it's about almost a year ago. And it says, and it's got a picture of Colin Powell. It says the shadow, let me see if I can move, they're moving some, oh, here we go. This is the shadow of anthrax. The voluntary COVID-19 vaccination effort owes much to past failures. Okay, wait, maybe this is not exactly saying what I expected it to say. I'll have to read this, but yeah, they're just talking about people who have declined
the vaccine. Yeah, there's
nothing
voluntary about it in the military.
Well, that's why I was, yeah, that's what immediately made me suspicious. Gulf War veterans, well, okay, so yeah, I got to take a look at this. Anthrax vaccine, yeah, they're separating. Nobody's related the two yet. At least not in the initial search. So we'll have to take a look at that, but yeah. But to me, it's the same problem. Now, it's different substance. I mean, COVID is a coronavirus. Anthrax was a different kind of thing, but they both caused massive health problems. Gulf War syndrome is a real thing, and it didn't come from people that all served in the Gulf. It came from people who were stateside who never left the United States. They still had Gulf War syndrome. So the fact that the military went through this, that they went through Agent Orange, that they went through burn pits, that they went through all of these things, and yet still mandated an experimental snake oil jab, knowing all these past controversies with things they rushed into.
Yep.
They don't give a damn about the soldiers.
It makes no sense.
Yeah, unless they're all being on the take, unless Big Pharma's paying them off, or someone's paying them off, or this is the way to the general staff, to your general or admiral post or rank. You know, why else would they do it? Look at General Milley. How did he get there? He's an idiot. You know, think about it. This guy called China. You know, his Chinese counterpart. How does he even know his Chinese counterpart to call him? I mean, you know, that was having suspicious right there. Anyway, so we have another rally coming up. Any more news on the rally, the Pensacola rally, or is that still just in the works?
The Pensacola one, no. I mean, I know that the 19th and 20th are the continuing ed classes that is open to people, not just medical people. If you're in the fight for medical freedom and aren't a healthcare provider like me, you're welcome to take the continuing ed class.
I have no idea what these are. This is news to me.
Oh, what, the continuing ed?
I was thinking like the rally. We have rallies at Blue Wahoo Stadium where some of the best doctors in the world come in and chat with us for a while.
Yeah. So they're doing, it's a two-day event, a day and a half of continuing ed, and then that night on the 20th is the rally.
Oh, it's like a teach-in. Okay. Well, I'll see if I can go.
Yeah.
Maybe I can go during the daytime. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Is there a section for citizen legislation there? Is that part of the teach-in?
That I don't know.
Okay. Can you ask
you know, some of the big names are going to be part of the continuing ed.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, people don't, you know, this is part of the education process, is that people don't consider citizen legislation because they've never seen it happen. They don't know enough about it, a viable form of activism. And so part of the biggest part of my job at Action Radio is to not only tell people about the citizen legislation, the actual bills, but the fact that it works. I know it works because I know when we had – I wrote a bill on the air, got it to Matt Gaetz. Matt Gaetz reported it favorably back to the show and took it to Washington. And that was all done within 5 days. So I know this works. But I need more people to know that it works and be supportive and go, yeah, I want this bill. I need people in Santa Rosa County to realize that if we create an illegal alien-free zone here, we're going to be a model for the whole country. And yet they don't think about that possibility. They don't project ahead. They don't, you know, there's no forecasting. There's no what if. People don't think, well, if we can do this, what are the ramifications? What are the possibilities? What is the potential? What would it be like to live in a county completely free of illegal aliens? No one thinks about that, which is unfortunate. But that's my battle.
Well, and, you know, I'm hoping to see something come from it because what we're doing isn't working.
Well, it's working for some people. It's not working for the American public.
Well,
it's
yeah.
working for the,
yeah,
the geldings and the Marxists.
The average citizen.
Yeah. Okay. Well, what did you think of the Marjorie Taylor Greene, Matt Gaetz, you know, roadshow?
I thought it was awesome. I mean, they had, at the Milton location, they had an amazing attendance.
Really? How many people do you think?
Yeah.
Did you get a number or approximation or a guess?
I couldn't even begin to guess, but the venue was, it was standing room only.
Okay. What kind of venue was it? Where were you?
It was a barn out on the outskirts of Milton, yeah.
What, horses and cows?
Beautiful.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah. It was on a farm. That had a beautiful barn that's, I
wow.
believe it's used for weddings and stuff like that. And it was packed. Like I said, standing room only. And obviously listening to them speak
inspiring.
You know, yeah, it was encouraging, inspiring. Certainly the crowd liked it. I'm becoming so cynical now because it's like you hear these great things
mm-hmm.
and then once
right.
you leave, it's, you know, what comes from it. So
well, you feel good, you walk away, you vote for them, and they're happy. But for me, the most important thing at these events is not to talk to Matt Gaetz. So I like to do that on the air, and I get a chance to talk to him briefly, but he's so busy, you know, he's not going to remember what we talk about. To me, it's much more important to talk to the staff. They're the folks that I need to get to know to get him on the show. Once he's on the show, then I can ask him all the questions I used to ask, you know, back at WBY. So did you get a chance to talk to anybody, staff or otherwise, or anybody, you know, or Matt Gaetz or Marjorie Taylor Greene themselves, and any impressions? I'm just curious.
Well, I talked to, to both Marjorie Taylor Greene and Matt, and I actually talked to Don, his campaign manager, you know,
mm-hmm.
trying to find out, what his position was on that petition to end the emergency declaration.
Oh, the discharge
petition.
You know, the one, yeah, what they say. I'm
yeah.
curious.
Well, Don didn't know his position on it, so that's why I then went to ask him about it. And
mm-hmm.
I went to Marjorie first, and I said,
mm-hmm.
you know, look, I see that you've signed this petition, but our friend Matt hasn't.
Mm-hmm.
And she said, oh, well, I will work on that and, you know, talk with him about it. So then I went to him next and said, you know, Marjorie's going to talk with you about this, but I've noticed you didn't sign it. And he said, oh, yeah, you know, I co-sponsored that initially. And I said, yeah, I noticed that, but I was curious why you hadn't signed the petition. And he said, you know, I haven't signed it because it's not going to change anything. It's not going to do anything. And, of course, there was a line of people, and they're hurting you in and out. So I didn't have time to get the follow-up. But I said, you know, from an optics situation, it doesn't look good that you haven't signed this. And he said he'd sign it, but, you know, that's the last I heard of it. So
yeah.
his comment was that it's not going to result in anything, which is why
he's right. As long as Nancy Pelosi is the single vote in the House of Representatives, because she controls everything, as long as they
but
have parties, you know, and they have a party, the major party has control of everything and elects the speaker, the House of Representatives is essentially, a speaker dictatorship, really.
But isn't that the way around it is to
– yes.
have enough signatures, 200 and some odd signatures,
mm-hmm.
That would then bypass her.
Yeah, but that only brings it to the floor. It doesn't pass it.
Well, then you get to see how everyone's going to vote. Isn't there some benefit to...
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you put them on the record, but it really doesn't matter because you figure most of those people, you know, when Pelosi said, I want you to vote to impeach Trump the second time, dutifully walked up and impeached Trump for the second time on a basically a poll. because they didn't do an investigation. They didn't do a hearing. They didn't do anything. So Nancy Pelosi controls the Democrats, and the Democrats control the House of Representatives. Therefore, Nancy Pelosi controls the House of Representatives.
Yeah, but with the medical freedom topic, you know, that's something I think a lot more Republicans agree on than Trump. Mm-hmm. There was a divide in the Republican Party about Trump. There's no denying that.
Yeah, that's for sure.
from a medical freedom standpoint, I'm hoping, I'm praying that the majority of those that identify as Republican agree with this needing to go, this emergency declaration. If not, they need to be identified, and that's the way to pull them out of the shadows. And remember that when it comes time to
out of
you
the
know,
closet, so
re-elect
to speak.
Them.
Out
yeah,
of the rhino closet.
Exactly.
Well, you know, you said
that's
something.
That's kind of the rationale that I have behind it.
Well, you said something.
And don't
amazing,
we want to do everything that that we can?
Oh, absolutely. But you got to understand that I understand where he's coming from, where Gates is coming from. Gates is a realist. He's voted against things that did nothing, even if everybody else in Congress voted for it. And he voted against something that people call it, you're against terrorists. No, I'm against doing nothing. I'm against spying on Americans for no reason. Okay. But he actually is really principled in that regard. I had a big argument yesterday with Bill Fecke, who kept bringing up, you know, what I call bogus sex scandals. Well, he's done this, he's done that. Remember, I said, okay, come on, give me a break. You know, prove it. This is, all Republicans who are conservatives who are effective get accused of a sex scandal. I mean, it's like Democrat 101. Anyway, but Gates is really good. He doesn't mind being the only person to vote for something. So in that respect, he's very principled. But here's the thing, though. That you just said that I found absolutely fascinating. You know, it's there's sort of like trans party. It's like transgender. So I'm going to come up with a new term, trans party. So I'm going to call them trans party Republicans. They identify, you know, they are Republicans, but they identify as Democrats. So I'm going to start calling them trans party Republicans. You like that? Or trans party Democrats.
Got a ring.
So there we go. So trans. I'm going to post this too. So trans. Two things you inspire me. You're great. Trans party Democrats are rhinos who haven't made the full transition.
haven't come out of the closet.
are rhinos who are GOP rhinos who haven't come out of the closet. Oh my God. Oh, this is hysterical. I have to do I got to make a political piece on this. I got to go back to the production board. I have these ideas here. Are GOP rhinos who haven't come out of the political closet. I wish I could write faster. I haven't come out of the political closet. See what you do? You're good for me. Come out of the political closet.
So, yeah, I want these people that are towing the line or supporting this nonsense, I want them to be identified, and I want people to remember it when it comes time to vote.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay, I want to squeak in our Santa Rosa Volunteers piece, because if I don't, Jonathan and you and me, can you stick around for a while? Or do you have to go at a certain point?
Yeah, today I stick around till 8, I believe.
Okay, good. So let me. Well, actually, 9 o'clock is when we finish. But if you want to stay till 8, that's okay too. It's only 7:18. We still got almost a little more than half the show to go. This is so much fun. But anyway, I want to play this piece because, you know, when you get the three of us together, we could talk all day. And cover all kinds of fascinating subjects. And we haven't
solve
talked to
the
John,
world's
John,
problems.
We do. We haven't talked to – talking. Let me – God, I can't even talk this morning. We haven't talked to Jonathan for 2 weeks. He was gone last week doing other stuff. Well, let me just tell you one thing. You know, I want to talk to Jonathan about this as well. I might as well talk to both of you at the same time. Jen Clark and I, she's in Australia. I'm here in Florida, have written – 30 rights we've compiled to an Australian Bill of Individual Rights. We did the narration. We have a three-hour presentation with 45 slides, which include the 30 slides of the rights. And we have a three-hour presentation that goes along with it, explaining everything. We record that Tuesday night. And so as soon as Jen releases it to me, I'm going to release it to everybody here in the United States. She's going to release it in Australia. We're going to have media focus groups. She's going to be doing media. I mean, I'm available for media too. The technology, the fact that we've never met. we've only met, the closest we met is Zoom. You know, here we are, two people across the world, okay, who have come together by, I'm sure, divine providence. I mean, there's a reason that we were brought together, have created a Bill of Rights you know, between our two countries for Australia, and this is actually applied to our country too. It would be fascinating. I think you're going to find some of the medical provisions absolutely staggering in the way that these things are written. And so, but that's what we've been able to do. And I'm hoping probably I'll spend most of next week talking about it as we take different sections, because 30 rights, you know, I talked to Jonathan about the first three last night, and probably bring those up as well. But it's an amazing, amazing document. I'm really proud of it. And I have no idea what's going to happen with it. It's going to be very interesting, because they have a national election coming up and they never had a Bill of Rights. And so for a country that's never had one, to jump into one this strong, I think it's going to be quite a process. All right, let me play a couple things. If you have a comment on that real quickly, and like I said, I'm sure we'll take it up later. But you're going to get it. Everybody's going to get it, you know, quite soon.
Well, and just what I was thinking when you said, you know, the power of technology, that you two have never met and are in different countries, mm-hmm. it just kind of flashed before my eyes that – you know, that is the power of, you know, mm-hmm. our technology, and why big tech is such a problem censoring half of the country, because it really does allow you to work together, find solutions. It made me realize how effective they can be at, you know, crippling one side of a fight by what they're mm-hmm. doing, censoring a particular set of information or facts, and we've got to address that.
I think it's part of the reason that we're not releasing it until it's done. Until it's a done deal, produced, yeah. You know, all set to go. And, of course, people can share it all kinds of ways. So we have the technology. We're using the technology. And there are ways around censorship. Of course, the biggest one is the thing that Cindy can tell you in, like, two sentences, which is our bill that fixes Section 230 of what was the Communications Decency Act. You should be an expert in that now. We've been over it a couple times. All right.
And I'm just waiting for it to happen.
Well, the more people that endorse it, the more people that send it to Congress, the more people that talk about it on talk shows, and the more people that inspire media to report on it, the sooner we'll get it. Until that happens, we won't get it. Let me play this back at the bottom of the hour with Jonathan. Hang on, Cindy. I'll mute you so you can go make noise, get a cup of coffee, and we'll all be back.
Okay.
I'll be back in a little bit. Here we go. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, insights into our founding documents, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers here in Santa Rosa County, Florida. Santa Rosa Volunteers is available at their website, srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. Preceding Karl Marx by 100 years or more, we have in Anti-Federalist Number 10, probably the first class analysis of politics. The author, A. Farmer, whom we've heard from before, got Anti-Federalist Number 10 published on March 18, 1788, in two Maryland newspapers. A. Farmer introduces the concept of parties, or classes, of individuals to whom want power. He says this: "As our citizens are now apprised of the progress of parties or political opinions on the continent, it is fit they should also be informed of the present state, force and designs of each, in order that they may form their decisions with safety to the public and themselves. This shall be given with all the precision and impartiality the author is capable of. America is at present divided into three classes or descriptions of men, and in a few years there will be but two." It's interesting to note that the founders were very much against political parties. They believed our greatest danger was a Congress divided into factions, what we today call the Democrats and Republicans. George Washington, in his farewell address, said this: "Political parties serve to organize a faction, to give it an artificial and extraordinary force, to put in the place of the delegated will of the nation, the will of the party, often a small but artful and enterprising minority of the community, and, according to the alternate triumphs of different parties, to make the public administration the mirror of the ill-concerted and incongruous projects of faction, rather than the organ of consistent and wholesome plans digested by common councils and modified by mutual interests. A. Farmer begins his political class analysis with this. The first class comprehends all those men of fortune and reputation who stepped forward in the late revolution, from opposition to the administration, rather than the government of Great Britain. All those aristocrats whose pride disdains equal law, many men of very large fortune who entertain real or imaginary fears for the security of property. They are at present wavering. They are generally, though with very many exceptions, openly for the proposed, but secretly against any American government. A burnt child dreads the fire, but should they see any fair prospect of confusion arise, these gentry will be off at any moment for these 5 and 20 years to come. Finally, this class contains more aggregate wisdom and moral virtue than both the other two together. It commands nearly 2/3 of the property and almost 1/2 the numbers of America, and has at present become almost irresistible from the name of the truly great and amiable man who, it has been said, is disposed to patronize it, and from the influence which it has over the second class. Pretty good analysis. Then A. Farmer continues with this. The second class is composed of those descriptions of men who are certainly more numerous with us than in any other part of the globe. We have a vast overproportion of these great men who, when you tell them that from the earliest period at which mankind devoted their attention to social happiness, it has been their uniform judgment that a government over governments cannot exist. That is, two governments operating on the same individual assume the smile of confidence and tell you of two people traveling the same road, of a perfect and precise division of the duties of the individual. Still, however, the political apophthegm is as old as the proverb that no man can serve two masters, and whoever will run their noddles against old proverbs will be sure to break them, however hard they may be. As the second class never can include any of the yeomanry of the nation of the Union, who never affect superior wisdom and can have no interest but the public good, it can be only said to exist at the birth of government. And as soon as the first and third classes become more decided in their views, this will divide with each and dissipate like a mist, or sink down into what are called moderate men, and become the tools and instruments of others. These people are prevented by a cloud from having any view, and if they are not virtuous, they at least preserve the appearance, which in this world amounts to the same thing. A. Farmer then reveals the third class. He says, in this third class may be counted men of the greatest mental powers and of as sublime virtue as any in America. They at present command nearly 1/3 of the property and above 1/2 the numbers of the United States. And in either event, they must continue to increase in influence by great desertions from both the other classes. If the proposed government is not adopted, theirs will be the prevalent opinion. The object of this class either is or will be purely federal, a union of independent states, not a government of individuals. The proposed government A. Farmer is addressing is one under the new Constitution, which the Federalists are attempting to ratify. It also appears that words like faction and party are used interchangeably, but mean different things. In this final statement by A. Farmer, I believe, his use of one party implies one big national government, which rules over the many other parties, which are the individual states. That is the goal of the Federalists, one Federalists, one party rule, despite their great efforts to hide this. Whereas the goal of the anti-Federalists is a government of the states, united, who have delegated very limited powers to and are supreme over the federal government, and where the states are preserved as multiple parties sovereign, balanced, and together they regulate any abuse of powers by the federal government. Consider carefully this final statement by A. Farmer. Learn this most difficult and necessary lesson, that on the preservation of parties, public liberty depends. Whether men are unanimous on great public questions, whenever there is but one party, freedom ceases and despotism commences. The object of a free and wise people should be so to balance parties that from the weakness of all you may be governed by the moderation of the combined judgments of the whole, not tyrannized over by the blind passions of a few individuals. The source for the Federalist Papers is federalistpapers.org. The Anti-Federalist Papers are from selfeducatedamerican.com. The Articles of Confederation are from usconstitution.net. This is Greg Penglis for Action Radio with Founding Moments, sponsored by Santa Rosa Volunteers. Their website is srv1776.com. That's srv1776.com. Please share this report to anyone who needs it. Action Radio, part of the ADHD Radio Network, the ultimate free speech zone. We the people give our consent to be governed through writing the laws by which we are governed, and have the power through juries to nullify the laws by which we do not consent to be governed. At Action Radio, we don't report the news. We are the news. Every other show reports what has happened. We talk about what can happen. From the questions no one has thought to ask, to the answers no one has thought to consider, to the actions no one has dared to take. That is Action Radio. And so without further ado, whatever ado is, I'm not going to ask, let's bring him back. Let's bring back the one and only Jonathan Mosley. Haven't heard from you for a couple of weeks, sir. Welcome back to the show. How you doing?
Fine. Yes. We do wonder about the ado. I was
step in the ado,
you know, there's
okay, fine,
there's much
yeah.
There's much talk about the aftermath. You know, recently I've said my brother actually, you know, ruined my sense of humor here. But there's much concern about the aftermath of things, and so I was wondering about the before math of things.
Before math. Well, there was, I don't know what happened before math. I'm just kidding. Cindy, I think we're getting
an echo from
your line again, or someone's giving an echo. One of you is right. Like a cell phone and a computer. Something is on that shouldn't be on, and it's maybe it's Jonathan. I don't know. Can you hear the echo?
No, not me.
Is it me?
I'm normal here.
I'm sitting where I normally sit.
Yeah, but I'm hearing there's an echo. It's a phone line or something is on in addition to
It could be. Maybe I could call. I mean, every now and then it seems like there really is such a thing as a bad circuit on the cell tower.
No, I don't think, because we had it with Cindy's line too earlier. It's like an echo. It's like if somebody has a cell phone on, the microphone picks up, and you have your computer on, you're listening to it, or somebody's listening to it nearby, or somehow it kind of like bounces. It's feedback thing, and it just sort of bounces back in. But it drives us all crazy to listen to it because you know you sound like you're in the stadium. You know, I'm the luckiest man. You know. Anyway.
Right. Maybe it's a self. Oh, maybe it's a solar flare. Or
yeah.
There you go. Now I can hear it. There's
okay,
some
good.
Kind of quasar. You want me to call back?
No. You're fine now. It sounds. Cindy, let me hear your voice.
Oh, sorry. I muted me. So it's me, but I don't know what I'm doing.
No, it's gone now, Jonathan.
No, it's. Yeah. Hello. Can you hear me? What test.
I'm not going
to
worry about that. I think just hear it on your line. Okay, everybody, forget the last minute of conversation. A little technical difficulties.
Yeah.
I'm hearing a little bit, but I'm not sure what it is. But that's okay. I'm not going to worry about it.
Well,
let's get on with it.
I don't want to be any more. I don't want to be any more annoying than normal.
Oh no, I like you being annoying. You know, annoying is good. Trust me,
just,
that's a requirement to be on the show. You know, annoying is a virtue.
I try not to be annoying or offend people. I just do it naturally.
Yeah,
But without trying. But anyway, so lots going on here,
mm-hmm.
and one, you know, as usual, it's kind of like we go to the wheel of issues,
mm-hmm.
And realize there's no way we can cover everything going on in the world. So it's somewhat arbitrary. And
I have a question first up, and you may not even know the answer to this one, but Cindy and I were talking about this. I've tried to look, when they say that the Brandon insurrection, the coup, is repealing Title 42, that's not true, because Title 42 covers the entire public health administration of the entire federal government. Do you happen to know what particular section of Title 42 they're talking about, the one that that said that the Trump administration or any administration could quarantine people at the border and not let them in the United States if they didn't pass basic public health qualifications?
No, I'd have to – I have it. People are using Title 42, of course, as a shorthand.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd have to – see, this is where I would normally put my phone down and put it on speakerphone, and then that's when we get into problems. To use my hands and look it up.
I looked up Title 42. It's huge. I mean, I posted Title 42, and I spent a little while going through it. And this thing is tens of thousands of pages of code. There's no way you can look mm-hmm. it up in a few minutes. So that whatever section they found that the bureaucrats and minions, you know, in the basement of the White House found that they're allowing them to do this, they're doing it. But I think it'd be interesting. I'll look myself. You know, if you look, you know, off the air, we'll
but
come back. And you always message me. We'll talk about it.
If you're putting a thumb on the wheel of issues, of course, you've heard about Title 42.
Mm-hmm.
My old classmate, who is Ken Cuccinelli, law school mm-hmm. classmate, who. I don't know. Maybe it's just that lawyers don't play well with others, but he.
I want him on the show if we can get him. But you know, someday, you know, a lot of people.
Well,
he
was sort of disappeared,
oh,
and then he sort
nice.
Of came back again. And I mean, he was not that prominent. I ran into him a year ago a year ago
mm-hmm.
at the Republican primary. And, you know, the because of COVID, we had what's called a disassembled convention,
to welcome the disassembly here this morning. Thank you very much.
I'm serious. It was ridiculous.
I believe
so what they did was they, instead of everybody getting together with a convention, which is both good and bad in the Republican, you know, party here in Virginia, because you get to hear speeches. The candidates give speeches. The they get endorsement speeches, and there's lots of activity
money?
On the floor.
Money
like at most conventions.
Money. Do they get money? Is this a fundraising thing?
No, it costs us money usually.
Oh, okay.
I mean, I don't not that I've seen. I mean, I'm sure it happens, but I've never seen that. But you know, most conventions and things, the most important things are not the official speeches. It's people talking to each other on the floor. Ron Wilcox, the head of the Northern Virginia Tea Party, maybe 8 years ago now, we were at a convention, and Pete Wilson was running for lieutenant governor, and
mm-hmm.
he was so impressed by the fact that somehow he said that he was undecided.
Hmm.
And as the head of the Northern Virginia Tea Party, he actually holds a lot of sway and has been in Virginia politics forever, even though he'll kind of look dumbfounded at you with a smile if you said he's important, but he is. And the Pete Snyder campaign noticed that he was undecided. And they quickly arranged somebody most likely to be appealing to him. They didn't just they went and they picked, and he could see them pointing to him and arranging this on the convention floor, and he found somebody who they picked this up, the person most likely to be persuasive with him to go over and talk to him. He's like, that really impressed him.
Says, that's
so,
lobbying.
So we lost the
disassembled. That's how it's done. Yeah,
that's how it's supposed to be done. Because those guys, because Ron Wilcox's analysis was, those guys know how to win. So I'm probably going to vote for them because when it comes to the state, to the general election, those guys know what they're doing. However, it usually takes all day, and people kind of hate that love-hate relationship. It's true. We have a distance. The Republican Party of Virginia vote for a disassembled convention. Like, oh my God, what a symbol of the Republican
chaos.
Party. chaos, yeah. So I ran into Ken Cuccinelli there and talked to him about the border and about the border wall. And he was, I think I reported at the time that he was, said there were supposedly lawsuits going on that we've never, haven't seen come to anything about whether Biden had the authority to cancel the border wall that had already been contracted. And,
this raises a fascinating point that this was contracted, that just because he issues an executive order, I mean, not even talking about the fact that he's illegally in the White House, but putting that aside, but any president issuing an executive order that violates contract law. This was established, paid for. Presidents can't do that. They can't simply stop something that another Congress and president did simply on an executive order. It takes, if it's done by statute, then it takes a statute to overturn that. Now, the next Congress can do it. For whatever reason, Congress matched up can do it, but a president cannot simply, violate contracts like that. I would question the Keystone Pipeline the same way. But the question is, and here's where it gets, I think, a little more interesting. Why is it that people are so willing to go along with something that some president said, or even did in writing when, that really has no effect, that the contract should have been fulfilled? They should have gone forward. How does that happen?
Because as I keep saying, is that quote-unquote experts inside Washington D.C. are absolutely dumb. They don't know anything about anything except what cocktail parties to go to. And they don't know anything about law or the Constitution. That's one of the reasons I went to law school, is because I realized that the government was half the two major parts of government are accounting and law. And most people who, don't know any law, and so they don't know how to do anything. All they know is, the tsetse fly or whatever has a 6-week lifespan, and this in their short lifetime, this is the way it's been done. So that's the way it must be the law. they're just acting out of ignorance. And
I think that's the average American's understanding or perception, is that if the president writes it, then that's the way it goes.
And I think at some point, I haven't studied this, but people have reported that, how they stopped teaching civics in schools.
Yes.
So the problem is that, and we've talked before about how when Trump issued executive orders to change policies, and I complained about his lawyers, who I think made a mess of things then and are making a mess of things today and are likely to get him indicted, they didn't explain this to him. And because when even though every person believes that when you get a new president, you get new policies, that's why we voted for him. It's change of agenda, change of policies. But the courts look at the executive branch as being continuous. So when the executive branch under Obama says, this is our determination of the facts and the law and what we should do, and then Trump comes along and changes it, the courts pretend that it's the same executive branch, whether led by Obama read by Biden. That's why you had all these court orders stopping what Trump wanted to do. And you say, well, why don't we do that? Well, damn good question. I don't know, because, again, Republican
lawyers. Yes, because they only work one way. You know, it's only like the Trump America First policies were reversed, and the Brandon and the fact, and we need to consider the fact that Brandon's not legally there. So we need to find out what's going to happen in terms of everything that he's done. You know, from nominating a Marxist to the Supreme Court, to stopping the pipeline, to everything he's doing in Ukraine, all these orders, executive orders, things like that. Technically, none of these are legal because we're still back at January 6th. And I know this is a big topic for a lot of people, but when you think about it, at some point we're going to have to account for the fact that everything he does is illegal.
Yeah, but we'll spend the next 2.5 years doing it. Meanwhile, he's continuing what he's doing.
Because people are letting him.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the geldings, the supplicants. You know, the Republican Party, yeah.
That's part of the reason for the cognitive dissonance is it's so why people cannot accept the fact, because if they did accept the fact, the consequences would be a mess. So their minds blot out the fact and don't want to accept it.
Well, I'm gonna let's focus on that for a second. So you're saying that people are so overwhelmed by the fact that we have an illegal person, that the election was stolen, that even the battleground states are not putting forward their Trump electors. That's going to be Monday's show. You know, that all these things are happening and people are complaining. They're looking at the price of gasoline. They're looking at the energy we don't have, looking at the stolen energy, the stolen economy, the ridiculous inflation rate. We could stop this tomorrow by simply putting forward the Trump electors like they should have been done, you know, November 4th. You know, 2020, all of this could be stopped at any time. So the dissonance is so bad. Not only are people accepting somebody in the White House that has no business being there, they're not accepting the fact that we have the cure and can stop this at any time, and preferring to complain instead about the high gas prices and the high inflation, you know, either knowing or not knowing that we could end this anytime we wanted to. That's the dissonance.
But that's the best hope we have of the truth and the facts. Coming out and being recognized is when people mm-hmm. finally realize that they want to recognize it. You know, people, you know, I was always raised that, you know, you put the facts and the truth first and then you come to your conclusions. But that's not the way, you know, that's not the way most people are. It's not the way society, especially under the if it feels good, do it. The hippies won. When it comes to that, we live in an emotional society where truth doesn't matter. And so the fact that this is painful enough that eventually people are going to say, people are going to, you know, they don't want to admit they were wrong, but they don't want what we're having either. So at some point something has to break and they realize that, you know, maybe I should reevaluate where I was.
Well,
so,
I mean, we can have $1.85 gasoline, but people tend to prefer complaining about $4.50 gasoline. I don't understand that. Where's the self-preservation? Where's the, you know, it's like the American spirit's either been bred out, destroyed, psychologically oppressed, mass psychosis, you know, obliterated, or all of the above. And it's like Americans refuse to be Americans. And here I'm saying as a born Canadian, you know, saying that I came to this country, you know, and said, wait a minute, you know, let's take what I thought America was supposed to be, you know, the land of the free mm-hmm. and the home of the brave, not the land of the oppressed and the home of the fearful. I don't want to live in that country.
Well, I mean, and, you know, neither did we think. Yeah, that's what we thought, too, here in America, born in America.
Yeah.
So, it's like I don't know if you saw about the Elon Musk people.
Yeah, let's talk about that. That's fascinating. And Cindy, feel free to jump in. Don't let Jonathan and me sort of like monopolize, because we tend to. Because we pull those numbers.
No, go ahead.
Yeah, yeah, okay.
No, but
Jonathan, you first. Elon Musk. What's
Elon Musk is there's a lot to talk about legally and financially, which I think people will want to know. But mm-hmm. of course, at first I was talking about how the staff at Twitter were freaking out. And the report was like they were panicking.
Oh, do tell. How were they freaking out? What happened? Oh, this is great.
I mean, the idea that we don't have exact details, but the fact that Elon Musk this is when he was just going to join the board, much less this morning. And I don't know
was
if
he
going to
join the board?
On.
Was he going to join the board?
On?
Or did he want to be a major shareholder? That's what we should talk about that too. Anyway, Cindy, yeah, go ahead with your question.
Yeah,
too.
Well, Elon Musk bought 9.2% of the. Of the shares. Oh, what mm-hmm. was that? How many billions of dollars was that? that was 9 No, that was 9.2% of the shares, and I'm blanking out on the dollar value of that when he bought them.
Lots of money. He's got it. Lots of billions.
But his stake has probably tripled in value since he had to reveal. The Securities and Exchange Commission requires disclosures. You buy some stock in Twitter, you don't have to tell anybody. But when somebody buys a major stake, they have to, I think it's over 5%, they have to disclose their intentions and their information about it. And again, it's a good example of what, you know, what the hell business is it of anybody, but the government intrusion requires these disclosures. So,
well, that's a law written by big business to protect big business from people that are actually trying to improve big business. I mean, that's the good old boy network. And of course, for Twitter, that means Marxists. You know, that means people that don't want free speech. So they're trying to protect themselves so they can continue to oppress free speech. And they're using securities and exchange laws on disclosure. But I think Elon Musk disclosed pretty well. There's plenty of cases of him on record, you know, on video saying that, free speech is critical. He used the word democracy, so I'll fault him for that. But he said very, very plainly that you cannot have a functioning country without free speech. I think his intentions are very clear.
Yeah. Jonathan? Well, the thing is that when he filed his I forget what the number is, his disclosure form, that he had acquired 9.2%. Of course, by then, he had already been buying previously, and some of his tweets make sense in that. So when he reached the timing when he had to disclose it, he already had 9.2%, which he bought relatively cheaply compared to what it's trading at now, and he had to declare whether or not it was a passive investment or an active, you know, a takeover.
I think it's pretty active.
Bid.
I think it's pretty obvious this is an active investment.
It became this morning. Yeah, I mean he could have like turned around and sold his 9.2% and made a ton of billions. And frankly, I think he might have done that and then waited for it to go back down again and then bought even more.
That's funny. Yeah.
Then they offered, and of course, Twitter did a brilliant move. Again, this is like Trump calling Putin's move before the invasion genius. Doesn't mean he's a good guy. It just means it was a clever move.
Mm-hmm.
And some of us just sit there and watch, you know, I hate everybody hates the Dallas Cowboys, but hey, that was a good play. Twitter did a brilliant move of offering to put him on the board of directors, which would come with golden handcuffs that he couldn't acquire more than 14.5% of the share.
Well, he could be outvoted. I mean, as soon as I heard board of directors, I thought, no, don't join the board of directors. They're going to outvote you every time. You got to have a bunch of Marxists and Elon Musk. You have one voice for free speech and a bunch of voices for oppression. I mean, he's not stupid. I don't think he's going to do that anyway. But the offer is kind of funny, I thought. Yeah,
this is why the Twitter employees who've been terrorizing their users and the country for quite a few years are now suddenly getting a taste of their own medicine, and they're now freaking out and screaming, and you know, according to people inside the company, they're having a freak out. They used a word that's worse, you know, I can't use on the radio. Not even one of George Carlin's seven
can
words.
Can you allude to it and give us a general direction? We can probably figure out the word.
They call it an experience of extreme, you know, panic and chaos going on.
Okay,
you know,
think of
Airplane, where everybody's, you know, jumping, you know, hanging upside down in the airplane and shaking back and forth and running around, you know, panicking.
Panicking because they can't censor anymore. Think about that. They're worried that they can't censor anymore. What kind of warped, disgusting people are there anyway? I mean, it's good that they're panicking. They should be panicking. They shouldn't be employed there in the first place. Because anybody that goes to a free speech organization to censor other people shouldn't be there. Sorry.
Just like the reaction to the Florida anti-grooming bill tells us why we needed it.
Mm-hmm.
If you could say, well, we didn't need this bill. Well, just look at how they're responding. So, yeah, I guess we did need it. So the reaction of the Twitter employees shows us how bad it really was if people are paying attention. So anyway, so he put – so The other thing that's interesting is that the clever move of putting, I think it's finally became clear, I mean, who knows when Elon Musk's lawyers, who are better than Donald Trump's lawyers, finally got around to telling him this. He might have known this immediately, but it started to get out in the media discussion, is that on the board of directors, Elon Musk would have fiduciary duties to Twitter. So there are things he couldn't say and he couldn't do because it would, if it might be contrary to the company's best interests. And I think that was part of it where he said, nope, not going to do that. So they were all ready to have the wedding ceremony, and he canceled the wedding.
So
and
he's then
Julie
this
Robert
morning
ran out of
the
church.
Board, correct?
Go ahead,
what's that?
Cindy?
He declined being on the board.
He
that
declined
was
the whole deal.
Okay, so what happened today? What
so
you...
this morning he filed the same type of declaration that I was just describing, where previously he said it was a passive investment. He now declared it's not a passive investment. He has decided to buy the entire thing. He's worth $250 billion. Much of his stock is in SpaceX and Tesla. So Tesla's shares have gone down 1.5% because people speculate that he might sell shares of Tesla to finance this. He says he's not going to do that. It's a leveraged buyout, which meaning that although he could afford to do it himself, he is going to put together financing. Some speculation on CNBC was that normally one should have the financing lined up. And he did this before when he was thinking of taking Tesla private. He didn't get his financing lined up in advance. But it doesn't matter. I mean, it's going to cost him $43 billion to buy the entire company.
Wow.
He's offering $54.20 a share, which is, like I say, 3 or 4 times what he paid for the initial 9.2% stake. So his cost basis, as CNBC is talking about, is going to change as a blend between the very low prices he paid originally and any shares he acquires now at the 54. I mean, I believe that I may be wrong on this, but I believe that means that individual shares, you know, he's probably buying up shares from individual investors right now. So his costs are going up. His average cost of ownership is going up. But he's going to need to get, you know, like I said, one reason I explained about the disclosure is that he already had 9.2% by the time he had to disclose it. He probably has a lot more than 9.2% now already that he hasn't had to disclose yet. He is, you know, this is, and typically what will happen then is the board has a fiduciary duty now to accept.
He doesn't.
His
oh, they
offer.
Have to do to accept it. Okay, that's interesting. So can boards reject his purchase of the company?
They can reject it if they think it's too low.
Oh.
If they can say that we don't think this is in the best interest of our shareholders because we think we could get more. And it was trading, I think, last year at 70, but that maybe, you know, people can make other arguments about that. So the tricky thing is the current board of directors must vote to accept his offer if they think, if objectively it's in the best interest of the shareholders.
Well, it is because it's going to bring in millions of Twitter people. They're going to come back to it. You know, I think Trump would come back to it and still keep Truth Social, you know, because that's more a counter to Facebook than it is to Twitter.
But this is fascinating. Because, you know, he's signaling to America that he's had it with the censorship, or is this a political or media stunt to help Tesla? I mean,
well, we don't know. But, I mean, because that would depend upon what's inside of his head. But I think that Elon Musk is what they used to say about, you know, widows, they would call dowagers, you know, rich widows, they're eccentric.
Mm.
You know, if somebody's poor, they're nuts. If they're rich, they're eccentric. He's got enough money to just do whatever the hell he wants to do. But the thing is, I don't think this is helping Tesla. The liberals who would normally be Tesla's, you know, heartthrob, are now hating him. And and MSNBC is calling Tesla racist. Naturally.
Oh, geez.
Well, this may be unrelated, though. This may be related to the fact that he came out saying we need more oil and gas in this country. He says, yes, I have an electric car company, but we need more oil and gas right now to improve the economy so people have more money so they can buy cars, including electric cars. So I think they hate him more for that than I see these are two different issues. I don't think they're related. And I got a thing on Elon as to why he's doing this just a bit. But what do you think of that, Jonathan? Do you see them as linked or not?
Well, the thing is what I'm saying is that when someone has enough mad money to be eccentric, I don't think you can fit them in a box because he has enough money to get up and do whatever the heck he wants to do today.
Mm-hmm. You what know, do you think so radio would be if I was a multi-billionaire? We'd have citizen legislation in every corner of the country, you know, and I wouldn't care what it costs. You know, so
he doesn't have to take positions that people like or dislike.
Mm-hmm.
What has his what's his position been? Has he vocalized his position on, you know, Facebook and Twitter censoring certain people or certain areas?
Yeah, I think he's
vocalized
gone, like most,
before.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but again, I think that it's sort of a moving target because as the censorship has gotten more extreme, more and more people have reacted by going, whoa, this is way different than what we expected.
Mm.
So, the extent to which people...
Well, let me give you my take on this, on Elon Musk. Elon Musk and Donald Trump are very similar people. They're rich enough to do what they want to do. Donald Trump has never held an elective office in his life. He is an America first person. He loves this country, loves Americans, loves what America is, what it stands for, and everything else. And he has something to do. And he never took money for it. He has never taken a single dollar of presidential salary. He didn't do it for the money. He did it because for him it was the right thing to do. Elon Musk, I think, is exactly in that same mold. He made a comment, you know, he says sometimes you have to lose money to make a point. Well, he's making a point here. And his point is that this country cannot function without free speech. It's time to stop this Marxist monopoly of our social media because it is so important. It is the information superhighway every bit as much as the interstate highways were back in the 50s and 60s. And when Democrat states didn't let black Americans, you know, go to restaurants and stay in hotels and do all these different things, that was a restraint of trade. That's where we got public accommodation from. Well, the information superhighway is every bit as much, you know, public accommodation as the interstate highways were then and still are now. And so the ideological discrimination is every bit as bad as racist discrimination was then. It's the same thing. It's still discrimination. It's still based on bigotry. The only difference is ideology versus race. And so Elon Musk, what he's saying is we cannot function as a nation without free speech. We cannot function if we're only getting one perspective, a propaganda perspective on every issue. You know, and there are many, you know, there are as many different perspectives as there are Americans who want to participate in Twitter. And we will function better as a republic. I hate that word democracy. We'll function better as a republic if we have as many points of view as want to be there on Twitter. And the explosion of information that is about to happen is unbelievably exciting. So if we got Trump at Truth Social, we got Elon Musk at Twitter, you know, this is going to open up. My only problem is I don't want to be dependent on billionaires to save us when we should have a legitimate Congress, state legislature.
But I will say that's an answered prayer because my husband and I have had, I don't know how many conversations about the where's the conservative side of what the Democrats and liberal agenda is accomplishing. Where are the people that have those kinds of money and clout and power on our side? What are they doing to, you know, contradict or counteract what they're doing on the other side?
Nothing.
I mean, to me, this is an answered prayer. If he truly is about you know, fighting that battle, because mm-hmm. that's what we need.
Well,
they've got the money and the power. We've got to have people in those positions on our side. Where are they and what are they doing to counteract it?
Especially with someone like Elon Musk, I think you have to think that he is a temporary ally. I don't think that in his heart of hearts he would identify as one of us.
Mm.
I would say like you know, and you talk about, you know, answer to prayer. I mean, who is the king? They are, you know, the Bible says that he, you know, God has the heart of the king in his hands. He could turn it like a river this way or that. And, you know, so, you know, it may be an answer to prayer, but it doesn't mean that in his heart, Elon Musk is totally on our side in every respect. It's like Samson, you know, was a horrible person in terms of his morality. But God used him because nobody else would do it.
Mm.
You know, so God will find somebody when there's nobody else. Like you said, where are all the godly?
Is that how I ended up here?
Like that.
Is that how I started this ridiculous project 5 years ago?
Apparently. Yeah.
Thanks, God. Appreciate the support. Yeah, okay, fine. Well, I'll keep going. You know, he's kind of inspired me. You know,
so that's why I say Elon Musk, I think, is quixotic. I mean, Elon Musk clearly has a desire to reshape society. He believes that mankind needs to diversify and live on Mars as well as on the Earth. I mean, so he has this desire to reshape humanity and reshape it. But he's also a raging pragmatist. So he, like when he says that I build electric cars,
mm-hmm.
but there's no way we can transition fast enough to electric cars.
But why would you want
to? You know, he's being,
you know, I mean, he builds electric cars, but that doesn't mean the gasoline cars are necessarily, because he builds electric cars, there shouldn't be gasoline cars. That makes no sense. Even if he does build electric cars, the reason he's got so many electric cars out there is subsidies. It's an ideological purchase that government is requiring. And he didn't even do that. They're putting all these subsidies on these electric cars because they think it's desirable. They're trying to social engineer us into electric cars. But I see no particular virtue in electric cars, especially on freeways. Now, city driving, okay, maybe, you know, especially if you're close to your home or charging station or work or something like that. Hybrids are the best, I think, because they have the dual technology. But on the freeway, there's nothing like a well-running gasoline, you know, internal combustion engine. They are so much more efficient and so much cleaner than they were 20 years ago. I mean, the technology is amazing, and it's still getting better. What's wrong with gasoline?
Well, and it's about time that we have someone. I mean, look at Bill Gates' efforts. You know, he's been doing this for decades to shape society into, you know, his new world order.
Yeah, but he wants
where
to
are
control.
The people on our side?
I don't think Elon Musk wants to control. I think he wants to open up. I think he wants to open up Twitter. And he'll probably tweet every day, several times a day. But that's okay.
Right.
As long as he's not restricting. Now, do you think he's going to restrict liberals? Do you think he's going to take the left and say, okay, just to be fair, you can't tweet for the next 5 years? Do you think that's going to happen? I would say no.
I would hope not.
Well, no, I don't think it's going to happen. But, I mean, that was sarcastic, actually.
I don't see Elon Musk being someone whose positions will change.
Yeah.
But his positions will be, you know, won't fit anybody's box.
Mm.
And
meaning they won't make
and
sense?
I think,
there
well,
won't be
perhaps.
Any continuity?
I mean, the idea that people must rigidly conform to certain agendas is perhaps what doesn't make sense. Is, you know, compared to the raging lunatics on the left, he is very pragmatic.
Hmm.
So, like, Bill Gates shares communist mentality of reshaping society. I don't know exactly what, you know, what, and again, communism, you say, well, that's incompatible with business. Not really. The elites always were rich and had all the benefits under every communist system. They just exploit the masses. And the mentality is to do things in the name of the people, what's for the greatest good, but in fact treat people like trash and unimportant and just cogs in the wheel.
Now keep going.
Bill Gates looks at improving society that people are expendable, whereas Elon Musk looks at improving society in a massively pragmatic way, which is, you know, he's not going to, you know, Stalin forcibly relocated people, different ethnic groups around the Soviet Union. Elon Musk is not going to force people to go live on Mars, but he thinks it's a pragmatic thing that humanity needs to live on more than one planet to survive long term. But he's not going to, he doesn't do that by viewing people as worthless pawns. So many of his positions, I think, will line up more with ours, but not all of them. But at the moment, he's going to do this. Now, he's got to come up with, he has made an offer that is full of loopholes, so he could back out very easily, and the media, you know, the business media is noticing that, that he could back out. But he is, hopefully, like I said, Miriam Adelson is Sheldon Adelson's widow. She's worth $30 billion, and she's 75 years old. I don't know anything about her children, but she can't spend $30 billion at age 75 unless she cryogenically freezes herself like we see in movies.
I can. Sorry.
You could? Yeah.
Oh, sure.
So, I mean, you know, there may be others who join Elon Musk, and that would be interesting. But he could, he could back out. And the thing is he's also expressed in, and these are official filings, that he has, part of his reasoning is his is his lack of confidence in current management, which means that if he wins, everybody in management is fired. Everybody in the current management of Twitter and the current board, they're gone. But like I say, he's offering 18% higher than yesterday's close of the stock, which is already like, what is it? It's already like three or four times higher than what it's been recently. So the board of directors actually has to act. See, this is why I say, on the board of directors, they have handcuffs themselves that if they don't act in the best interest of the shareholders rather than themselves, they are in trouble.
What type of trouble does that bring?
Both SEC regulation and lawsuits from shareholders.
Mm.
It's like because shareholders who, when it was trading, they changed the, like when it was trading at like 20, or 30 a few months ago, and now they could sell at 54.20. The best interest of the shareholders is to sell, you know, to double their money, unless the case can be made, well, you're offering too little. You know, here's what, because yes, it was at one point in time trading at 70, but then there are other factors, and someone has to make, you know, an analysis of all that. And somebody says, no, it's in the best interest of the share of the thing. Now the thing is, the other thing too, is the current board can try to finance their own buyout. They can do a defensive battle, which I'm sure they will. And there's enough billionaires on the wrong side of this.
Mm.
They may come to the, there may be a bidding war for those shares of stock.
Well, and I'm just
you might
wondering
realize
if, I was just
I probably should have said at the beginning that I have a finance degree undergraduate from the University of Florida before I went to law school. I might have mentioned earlier. But,
the multi-talented, multi-dimensional Jonathan Moseley.
Yes. Yeah. Scary, but a little bit of everything. But I'm happy to be proven wrong if anyone –
Yeah.
Has
See, I don't look at this
point
as,
of view.
Yeah, no, I think you're absolutely right on in your financial analysis. I think that Musk is not about finances at this point. He's got so much money, he doesn't have to worry about it. This isn't a financial endeavor. Yes, he could buy the shares. You know, the company could go up, and he could sell the shares and make a whole bunch of money. At this point, a whole bunch of money is almost like an irrelevant term because he already has so much money. Making a whole bunch more is not really a good deal. He's about, I think what happens is people get to a certain point where they have so much money that the accumulation of more money is just kind of silly. So now they want to do something good. Now they want to have a legacy. Now they want to make a change they've always wanted to do. Now they want, I'm doing the same thing, except I'm doing it on no money, which is kind of interesting. But you look at,
right.
I think I'm working on the strength of ideas, and everybody that likes the strength of the ideas we have here, including the soon-to-be-released Australian Bill of Individual Rights. You want to talk about new ideas? That's going to blow everybody away. But he is about ideas. He is about, this is what SpaceX is about. He saw a need and he filled it. Okay, NASA wasn't doing their job because you had a bunch of liberal idiots, you know, particularly Obama, that didn't see the value in space travel. So he brought it back. Now, of course, NASA is getting back into it because they don't want to be left behind. You look at different things that really wealthy people have done. Patrons of the art. Somebody sponsored Beethoven. Okay, Beethoven didn't have any money. He just happened to be one of the world's greatest composers. Okay, but he had a patron. Okay, I don't know who that patron is, but somebody funded Beethoven. Somebody funded Mozart.
Sure.
Somebody funded Michelangelo. You look at all the great things that have happened. Well, not all of them. I mean, the Wright brothers were bicycle mechanics. They did it themselves on the strength of their ideas. So either, you know, and so there's some very wonderful things that happen. There are people that want to see change, and you may not know who they are. In this case, we do know who it is. We know exactly who it is. Elon Musk is doing this to make a point. He's making the point that we're a better country and that we will survive, you know, much better with an open and free debate on Twitter, Twitter being one of the greatest ways for people to get their point of view out there. He is probably disgusted, you know, with the fact that that it's been so suppressed, that it is such a single point of view, that he's going to say, okay, I'm going to buy the company. I'm going to turn this around. I'm going to make it what it was supposed to be, a completely free speech outlet. I don't think he's going to restrict it at all. I think the left is going crazy because it's going to cost them their power. Tucker Carlson's been big on this too. He's doing this because he can't. So in other words, the money is a means. The money is not the end. The money is not the goal. Making money really has nothing to do with it. Money is basically the tool. You know, money is like the wrench to a mechanic. Okay. Money is the means to be able to do what he wants to do. And what he wants to do is open up Twitter. He's going to purge it of all the censors, the Marxists. You know, and it's going to come out a really fascinating place to see what happens. People might start reading my tweet. I tweet the show out every day. But you just imagine how much I'm suppressed. You see some of the titles of my show. So, yeah.
But you see how, as we've already discussed, I'm not repeating, he has to play this out against the regulatory background of talking about money.
Well, and they can use it against him.
They're
going to try and sue him. They're going to try and stop him. He's going to go through the equivalent of a Trump impeachment.
Wow.
Oh, yeah.
Well, and I'm wondering, you know, what considerations the board would take as a, you know, the Pfizer mentality to take the lawsuits and whatnot, because to move forward with it, where was I going with that? You know, where they put the drug out, even though it had, you know, side effects and the financial damages that they incurred because of it, the profits outweighed, you know, the lawsuits and whatnot to
That's a really
sell
fascinating
the drug
question.
Anyway.
Yeah, I want to kind of rephrase it just a little bit for Jonathan to ask sort of like a bigger question. Is it in their fiduciary responsibility to put out something, let's take Pfizer, because they have immunity, you know, they're not going to be sued for putting out a dangerous product, a dangerous experimental drug, you know, known as a vaccine. Okay, so in the interest of fiduciary responsibility, are they duty bound to keep pushing that, knowing that they're making billions of dollars of profit, knowing that they can't be held liable for the damage that is done? So in the strict sense of bean counting, of maximizing profits, they're actually maximizing profits, even though people are dying and getting injured and crippled because of this thing. But if you look at it in purely monetary terms, they're making a fortune.
And they've done that with drugs in the past where they didn't have the liability protection. So the cost, you know, while it was great, the financial incentives for selling it, you know, overruled, you know, the losses through.
Listen. let's take cases because these are both interesting. But for the case where they have, there's no liability, is the board of directors duty bound a fiduciary responsibility to maximize profits, bound to keep selling a product regardless of its health effects because it's making money because they're immune from liability? That's my first question. Then Cindy's question.
Well, you're transitioning to different kinds of products, but that is in part what Elon Musk is alleging, is that Twitter's policies and their management and the way they're handling things, both in terms of censorship and in other ways, is making the company way less valuable to the shareholders than it should be. And,
wait a minute, it's way more valuable because they're going to expand the market to all the conservatives who are kicked out.
He is alleging that they are selling it. What?
Well, no, the company, you could say, I would argue that it's in the interest of the company to bring back all the conservatives that they banned. You know, I mean, what company, why is it, it's not a fiduciary responsibility to get rid of half your customer base. That's insane. That's irrational. That would be against your fiduciary responsibility. That's what I'd argue.
And that's not the only aspect that he's criticizing. He's criticizing both the censorship and other mismanagement and weaknesses in the product, so to say.
Okay.
Like you're saying.
Well, let's get back to Pfizer for a second. You know, all right, go ahead and finish. Then I want to get back to this. I think Cindy's really a great point. All right, so is it, and we're talking just, and I get to the Ford Pinto in a little bit too. We're going to figure product liability. If a company makes money, regardless of whether that product is dangerous or not, if it makes money, is it strictly in the fiduciary interest? The board of directors, are they duty bound by fiduciary rules to maximize profits, regardless of whether the product is safe or not?
Yeah.
In the context of their fiduciary duty, their duty is to the shareholders to maximize profit. They could go to jail. In the context of fiduciary duty.
Well, that's all we're talking about.
In terms of the fiduciary duty to their shareholders, if the net profit is higher, then they're fulfilling their fiduciary duty. The government could indict them. The government could sue them. The government could,
right.
In other legal contexts, there could be other consequences.
That. This is just...
Just their duty to their shareholders.
Just board of directors' responsibility, yeah.
Right, unless there are consequences in other legal realms that are so catastrophic that it harms the company.
Okay,
But
they've got liability protection. There are consequences. That's what I'm saying. Then I want to take the case where they don't have liability protection. But if they were immune from lawsuits for any of the consequences of their vaccine snake oil and messenger RNA jabs, if they're immune from that, there are no adverse financial consequences. The government has actually mandated it. Okay, so as far as the board of directors of Pfizer is concerned, there are no bad fiduciary effects. They're actually insulated and protected from adverse fiduciary effects. Are they duty-bound by the rules of fiduciary rules to keep promoting that product, whether or not it's dangerous in killing people and having athletes drop dead in the field? Because it makes money, therefore they have to keep doing it. That's what you're saying?
Wow.
If it increases value to the shareholders, then yes.
That's okay. So gross.
And the thing is, the board of directors and the officers, have insurance, errors and omission assurance, insurance. They have liability insurance. They've got indemnification agreements where the company will reimburse them if they're sued or if they're found liable of something. Now, there are limits to that, and insurance companies, of course, always try to find a way not to pay. but there are equivalents in corporate governance that are pretty close to the immunity.
So they're not only is the company immune from lawsuit, but the directors are immune from the consequences of their action, fulfilling their fiduciary duties to raise profits at all costs, regardless of how many people are killed or injured by the snake oil jab.
Yes, but what I was saying was that the immunity of boards of directors and officers is not just limited to Pfizer. That's limited to any corporation big enough to be able to afford them. Your mom and pop dentist probably can't afford to do that, but
Pfizer wasn't doing Pfizer wasn't doing something as an exception in their decisions in the past to go ahead and sell something that they knew the liability and risk was there and welcomed the lawsuits and whatnot.
Right, but bear in mind that they are selling a highly regulated product. So outside the fiduciary duty to their shareholders, they have other considerations. Hmm. But strictly speaking, as there's their duty to their shareholders, yes.
Wow.
I mean, if they said, look, you know, we could make more money, but we'd be breaking the law, then they'd probably be, you know, they probably would not be breaking their fiduciary duty. But just in terms of fiduciary duty, they, you know, in terms of money or whatever, their job is to make as much money as possible.
Okay, so let's reverse the question.
Morals and ethics aside.
Yes.
So this is fascinating. This is why I want to kind of focus on this. Now let's reverse the question. Let's say that this board of directors of Pfizer or any of these snake oil jab manufacturers gets a conscience and says, we think we should pull our product off the market because we need to test it for another 10 years to see the long-term effects and to make sure that it actually is safe and effective. That would be against their fiduciary responsibility because the vaccine snake oil manufacturers are making so much money right now, billions upon billions of dollars. That would actually be against their fiduciary responsibility to do the responsible thing and pull the damn snake oil jab off the market, wouldn't it, Jonathan?
Yeah. There are arguments, like I say, for example, look at Arthur Anderson, where they were out of business. Because of certain things, one could argue that the regulatory environment could be so problematic that it could threaten the company. They could try to justify their position in sacrificing profits for other considerations, but they'd have to be able to explain that and make it persuasive as to why not making the most amount of money is really in the best interest of the continued viability of the company, including, you know, they could lose licensing, they could lose, you know, making regulators happy may be so critical to continuation of the business that they could justify an exception, but they would have to be prepared to, you know, lay it out on paper and show why they did it.
Okay. No.
That is so discouraging. I really thought that Pfizer was the exception to the rule. But it amazes me to think that boards all over the country sit down and make those calculated risks.
And that's exactly why I wanted to ask that question. All right, let's take another case that we're familiar with, or most people are, the Ford Pinto. The bean counters at Ford, in their fiduciary responsibility, determined that the $9 it would have taken to move that gas tank up several inches further would have cost more than the lawsuits from the deaths of the people who were burned to death when the back of the Pinto exploded in a rear-end collision when the bumper went into the fuel tank, sprayed fuel on the exhaust pipes, and caught fire. Now, I happen to have ridden in the back of a Pinto all over Vancouver when my family, my folks took me to this is why this is a very personal story to me, okay? Now, obviously, I didn't get rear-ended. That's why I'm still here. But when I think about that I rode for an entire day cooped up at my 6-foot or whatever my 5-foot-plus frame was, and, you know, suffering in the back of a Pinto, I didn't know that I could have died at any second if we got rear-ended, okay?
Well,
but when you think about that.
Times you could sue your parents. You could go back and retroactively sue them for that.
They've both passed on from this world. But the point is, and I reminded them of that fact too when it came out on the Pinterest. You may be sitting one of those things. Anyway, but the point is that they made the decision, you know, the fiduciary decision that they could save more money by saving $9 per Pinto than it would have cost them to settle the deaths of people that died in an exploding gas tank.
And in my naive little world that I live in, I just thought they didn't know that they discovered after the fact.
Nope. Not according to the internal
so
documents
crappy.
That were revealed. That's why free markets should never be totally free. You got to have some kind of regulation or people will do things like this. Jonathan, what do you think? Product liability?
that the analysis they made, of course, mm-hmm. ended up being wrong.
Well, yeah.
Their analysis that it was cheaper
That's
to take the,
point.
The risk. Yeah. Their analysis that taking the risk was cheaper than fixing it, you know, was massively incorrect, including with the publicity and the crusaders in the media and the crusaders in the lawsuits and other things like that. So, you know, they could be accused of malfeasance in making a radically incorrect analysis.
Yeah, but how
that
many
they
people
should have known that their analysis was wrong?
How many people okayed
and
that
so
decision?
That would violate the fiduciary duty.
Oh, okay, so that's different. But how many people okayed that decision? You know, from the engineer, the whistleblowers, there had to be whistleblowers that say, you can't do this, people are going to die. And somewhere along the way, the accountant said, no, it's okay, we're the bean counter said, oh, we're still going to make more money. You know, if several thousand people die, we've calculated our actuarials. Someone actually did a death calculation that the lawsuits would not exceed the cost of that they would save more money by leaving the gas tank where it was. So, and they had to go all the way up through, I guess, the board, you know, or at least maybe the president of the company, the CEO, you know, had to go through a lot of different people, okayed that decision.
And I look at the media, too. Why did they decide to point them out as the villain, whereas a company like Pfizer, you know, the media isn't villainizing them for those types of decisions?
Different media, different time, I would say. But Jonathan, what do you
think?
Yeah,
and one,
to show
one,
you the
one
power
could say
of the media.
That one could say that the Pinto didn't spend enough advertising dollars on the networks.
Mm.
You know, if they spent more dollars advertising and kept people afloat, who knows? But the, you know, for example, we were talking earlier, remember that rich liberals are the only reason CNN and the Washington Post and the New York Times are still in business.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if they had to sink or swim on their own merits, they'd be out of business by now.
Gosh, money really is the root of all evil.
No, that's not the quote. No, the love of money is the root of all evil. There's nothing inherently evil about money. Money actually got us out of bartering. Money is a great exchange. Money allows us to do things. Money allows us to accumulate wealth. It's a liquid commodity. So instead of having to trade, you know, something that you grew in your garden for the eggs from somebody else's farm, we have a medium of exchange. There's nothing wrong with money. Money's a good thing. Money has one of the greatest things that has allowed us to progress, you know, out of the caves. You know, and you look at Roman society, roads, clean water, and sewers. And I would include money in that. The trade routes that were set up all through the Middle East and Mesopotamia on were all based on money, on having a medium of exchange. There's nothing wrong with money. And, you know, but the question is the abuse of money, the love of money. You know, the love of money that Pfizer is seeing now that they're putting the snake oil jab on the market, the love of money that Ford had that they didn't want to move the damn fuel tank a few inches more forward so it wouldn't be hit by a crushed bumper, the love of money that goes on in so many different places, you know, that screws up the market, that really makes, you know, a lot of people's lives miserable, the people that do frivolous lawsuits, you know, all the things that happen, the people that are running into this country to take our tax dollars, the love of money. Is the problem.
But it's like Jonathan pointed out, it goes far beyond that, buying a good and service. It's funding a media outlet to persuade them to push a certain narrative. How if we're able to buy every aspect of an opinion or facts in any facet of society, how are we a free and healthy society?
Well, freedom has to be enforced. I mean, Bill Gates gave $300 million to media outfits, you know, CNN, all the leftist ones, to pass on his propaganda. The CIA used to pay journalists. I mean, the fact journalists have been paid for a long time, which makes them not journalists. Jonathan, you probably know more about this than I do. You're in Washington there. But the amount of money that I think should not be allowed to go in, money that goes to NPR, for example, National Socialist Marxist Public Radio, has an unfair competitive advantage because they don't have to go after commercials. They can put more subject matter on the air simply because they're being artificially supported by tax dollars. That, to me, would be a trade infringement, I would think, on all the other media. But the amount of money that goes into media to influence media is staggering. Jonathan.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess to be informative, but you know, but fair is like in the early part of our country, there were a lot of newspapers that were openly aligned, you know, with certain political parties or interests or things like that.
I don't care about that as long as they state their alliance. I don't care. We got that today. You used to have what each city had, like in Boston, we had the Boston Herald, which is the afternoon paper, you know, which was the conservative version, and then you had the Boston Globe, which is the morning paper, which is the liberal version of the
and
news.
And that's what's missing.
But everybody knew
now.
It.
There
everybody
is,
knew it.
There is no representation from both sides, and why is that? It's fine to have it as long as both sides are represented. Where has the other side gone?
Geldings,
supplicants, I don't know. It's a good
controlled
question.
Opposition, cowards, weak.
I
wimpy.
Believe it's money. It goes back to money. Do they just have that much more money, or is our side not willing to spend their money? What is it?
Well, I think you're right on both counts.
That's sad.
Yeah, I think. Well, I mean, I've given you my analysis, which you know I did not arrive at flippantly, but. Doing this stuff since 1984, and what you know the issue is that you know the two issues I see are that our you know our side are weenies, and we're on you know the many people have said long before me that the GOP is the stupid party. I didn't say that. A lot of analysis has said that. Is that the Democrats are evil and the Republicans are stupid. And,
that's about right.
You know, so I mean, I've said before, there are plenty of tools to do what needs to be done, but we just don't have the will to do it.
Well, that's the problem with Action Radio. We've got the citizen legislation, but no one wants to send it to Congress or the media, you know, things that would make us much more free than we are now. You know, the two big ones are our Section 230 rewrite and our vaccine product liability bill. Both of those would have a huge impact on the country. And yet,
well, to me, it goes back to money because you do have people on our side like us, you know, just the three of us. None of us have money, but we're willing to fight for what's right.
Mm-hmm. We have ideas.
The people on our side that have that power to do it aren't doing it. Is it because they don't want to give up their gravy train? Per se, I can't wrap my head around why we have people that are willing to fight it. I have to believe some of those people are in positions of power that could affect the change. Why are they not doing it?
Yeah, let's take Heritage and the NRA, two big groups that have millions upon millions of dollars, you know, in their respective areas, and yet. Like I joke frequently, the Heritage spends more on their luncheons, you know, one of them, than I probably spend on Action Radio in an entire year.
So it's not that we're dumb. We've got smart people with money in positions of power.
Mm-hmm. Jonathan?
They just, I mean, I used to work in with John Kwapitz, who was here, you know, that I used to work in the building. The Center for Peace and Freedom rent was on the third floor of the Heritage Foundation, and yeah, I can attest to that.
Third floor.
John Grigsby, who used to be a conservative, was he went up to the actual Heritage Foundation floors, the upper floors. Of the building, and he was passing out a flyer for a demonstration or something, and he got thrown out because they don't do they don't do activism.
A conservative foundation doesn't do activism. How do they raise so much money? And how many floors do they have? How big is this building? we're talking about here?
It's a very central, expensive building. They rent out some of the lower floors. I think they've got the three top floors. And they threw John Grigsby out because he was passing out flyers for a demonstration.
Free speech heritage. Well, we know that now. Hey, listen.
if he'd been passing out flyers for a wine and cheese party, I'm sure it would have been fine.
That's a good point. Hey, let me hold you up just for a second here. I want to play something real quick on my book, and then I want to come back. We only have about 20 minutes left, and there's a couple of other issues I want to talk about, particularly, Jonathan, you found this, and I found an article too. We've got judges who are starting to actually enforce the Constitution, and one actually agreed with my characterization of January 6th as a Capitol Hill invitational walk-in. And so if you want to cover that for a little bit, let's get to that and any other issues we might want to talk about. Also, this grooming bill, that whole word grooming disgusts me because I don't think it's anywhere near as close to the pedophilia access and indoctrination. That would be a lot stronger term than grooming. Anyway, back in about a minute.
And I would
continue. Greg Penglis here for my book, The Complete Guide to Flight Instruction. Everyone at some point in their life wants to learn how to fly. Few try. Even fewer go on to get a license. I believe a major reason for that is how we teach people how to fly. My book is designed to help you navigate the flight training system, but it's so much more than that. It really describes an entirely new way to teach flying. So if you've never tried a lesson or got discouraged in your training and quit for any reason, this book can help you. Don't be a rote pilot who just follows procedures. Be a thinking pilot who makes great decisions, who understands all the reasons why we do what we do. You can incorporate these principles into your own flight training at any time. The Complete Guide to Flight Instruction is featured on the Action Radio with Greg Penglis Facebook page and is available from Amazon.com.
Action Radio, dedicated to fixing everything.
And that's what it's all about. Back to you, Cindy. You had a point.
I was just going to ask Jonathan on the recent verdicts for the January 6th defendants, how that's going to play into his clients. That seemed very encouraging.
Yeah, I didn't know if we I guess that happened since last Thursday. Last time I was at – I couldn't be on last Thursday.
Yeah, you got busy.
So,
stuff happens.
I had to be in court. It's very interesting. And also Alan Dershowitz has gotten involved, and he also has commented on this too. And see, this is where I'm saying that ordinary rules for ordinary clients, are not what's happening here. We've all heard that, you're presumed innocent until proven guilty. And any criminal law requires a certain level of knowledge. You can't, if one is sleepwalking, and you can't be held responsible for things you didn't intend to do. But certain laws have a higher level. For example, in that case, most common charges that everyone has had are knowingly entering a restricted area without lawful authorization. And again, people say, "Oh, you were in a restricted area." Nope, that's not the statute. The statute is you were knowingly in a restricted area, and you were in a restricted area without authorization. So, right now, there's a video up at Gateway Pundit and other people's. It's being shopped around by the team that Alan Dershowitz is on. It comes from Joe McBride. It's an edited version of what Joe McBride got released publicly from the West Upper Terrace, and it appears to show a police officer, as Greg Penglis has been saying for a year and a quarter, showing police officers actually either waving people in or what a person could reasonably believe is acceptance of them being there. And, the normal law, if we were actually following the law, is the government must prove that someone, beyond a reasonable doubt, not just
You know, we kind of think, sort of speculating, you know, maybe, but beyond a reasonable doubt, that the person knew they were entering a restricted area. It's important to understand, and everybody's, you know, assumptions are the enemy of thought, it seems to me, that there are no permanent signs. There are no permanent signs around the Congress saying, watch out, sometimes the Capitol is closed. Everybody says, oh, it was closed for COVID. There are no signs saying closed for COVID. You know, so they have these little paper signs up on the bike racks, and one photograph shows the paper sign being torn in two, showing it's just a flimsy piece of paper. And those bike racks, of course, were moved. So the government actually has to prove, and again, these are the most common of the 800 people. Most of them are charged with with entering a restricted area or parading and demonstrating in a restricted area. So this affects almost everybody who's been charged, although some people have more serious charges as well. So what the judge did, Judge McFadden, did is just, you know, like C.S. Lewis, mere Christianity is just, you know, simple mere law, is you actually have to prove the elements of the crime. And he was in one trial, he dropped. This is the cowboy, the Trump guy.
He's been on the show. He's been on the show, by the way, too.
Yeah, I think I remember hearing that. And so he dropped one of the charges because they hadn't proved it. But on the other one, he said, "Well, no, I don't know if he was the guy. I don't want to unfairly characterize him because I forget who it was." But Judge McFadden said, "Well, the guy crawled up over several walls, you know, rappelling, you know, mountain climbing up over walls and going through. So even if he didn't see the sign, you could, you know, he probably knew he shouldn't have been there because he was like crawling over walls and helping up and things like that. And so, therefore, you know, they've shown that he had knowledge that he was entering an area where he wasn't supposed to be." In the case of Matthew Martin, the judge said that, he specifically said, we're waiting for the transcript because we want to give it to everybody when the transcript of the court reporter is ready, is that he says, I forget exactly how he said it, but he says, the judge McFadden said, if you know, you might think he probably knew, but that's not good enough. You have to actually prove beyond a reasonable doubt that he had knowledge that he was entering a restricted area, and they have not proven that. He was found not guilty of all charges. That was the third actual real trial, and the government lost. And
isn't it great when the government loses? They lost the FBI thing in Governor Widmer. They lost a bunch of other trials. They lost so many things, and they should lose because they're acting as criminals. I got Pianca on the line, too. I'll get to him in a second. Go ahead, Jonathan.
Yeah, because they should have lost. And so the other aspect – so the thing is simply – and this is what Alan Dershowitz says – now, the left seems to think that Alan Dershowitz is a conservative. I mean, Alan Dershowitz is a raging liberal. But like Jonathan Turley, they are raging constitutionalists. They don't care who it benefits, who it hurts. They're
liberals that are good liberals.
The law and stick with
in the sense, they're liberals in the sense of the good sense of the liberal. They love their country. They love the Constitution. They just have a different way of solving the problems. I have no problem with Dershowitz whatsoever, or Jonathan Turley, even though I will disagree with him on a lot of issues.
But he doesn't agree with anything that the January 6th people stood for or were doing or why they were doing it, but he's going to fight for – he's always fought for freedom of speech the way liberal lawyers used to do, even for unpopular defendants, because, you know, they realize is that if freedom of speech and due process can be denied to unpopular defendants, it can eventually be denied to all of us. And that's been his position all along. So Alan Dershowitz has joined the legal defense, although I searched, he has not actually officially entered any of the cases. He is backing up Brady Knowlton, and where's the other guy? And he's very publicly touting the same case and the same reasoning, just as I described it, and as Cindy texted asking about it, that, you know, he, even though he's not technically in the case, he's part of the team, and he's been very, very public about the fact that if this is the rule, which of course it should have been, that you know, that they win, at least on all the, and this affects, like I say, hundreds of people. A lot of people have already pled guilty too. Mm-hmm. And now the other thing Alan Dershowitz is also doing, and I'm on a case with Cynthia Ballinger Price and Christopher Price, and working with a great lawyer, Nandan. He is about to file a motion to dismiss, including the fact that the statute against parading, demonstrating inside the Capitol is unconstitutional, is vague, and it goes against the First Amendment.
Hmm.
And because you can't, what the hell does parading mean? Because when you want to establish something in law, the perfect plaintiff is important. These guys are the perfect plaintiffs, because all they did was a couple, they walked inside, 3 minutes later, they turned around and walked out. No signs, nothing like that, and they were charged as parading and demonstrating.
Really?
So, yep. So if they get to the point where, we can challenge the constitutionality of that statute, almost everybody has been charged with that statute as a misdemeanor, as well as other people have been charged with more. So that could be hugely consequential, and no less than Alan Dershowitz is also on that point too.
See, this is why I've always called it the Capitol Hill Invitational Walk-In. I don't make up these terms capriciously. I mean, there's a reason why I did it. It's because I wanted it characterized properly. And the fact that a judge has said virtually the same thing is hysterical and actually kind of vindication. There we go. Anyway, it's fascinating the way it's working. Anyway, let me get to Bianca real quick. We only have 8 minutes left. I want to make sure he gets a word in here too. All right, Jonathan, do you want to have a comment real quick? Bianca, go ahead.
What about the guards that were leading people up the steps, Jonathan? That's an invitation. Come on, you see.
Yeah, it is.
Remember
the video that just came out?
Well, I've seen it earlier.
Yeah.
Well, this came out. I seen that video of him doing it early on. The black guard, and somebody said they made him a hero. He was leading people up the steps. Said, come on,
come on down. Price is right. Come on down to the Capitol. This is your chance to take a selfie beside a famous statue.
Yeah, he was going up the steps though. He wasn't going down. He was going up the steps.
Come on up.
Yeah,
come
that
on
was.
Up to your
that,
Capitol.
I think that's
Sorry.
Posted at Ben's. bandvideo.com, which is part of Alex Jones. And that's where, and apparently if it's the same video I'm thinking of, part of the context was that there were people in trouble inside the Capitol, and they were trying to go in and bring Oath Keepers in to help officers who were actually being threatened quite severely inside the Capitol by a different group of people, by a small group of troublemakers who are probably, you know, like, where did Antifa, like I say, one of the big mysteries about January 6th is where did Antifa disappear to? You know, in every other demonstration, Antifa was there. Where did they go to? Did they just put on other clothes? So the thing is that what Judge McFadden did is what he should have done, what every judge should do, is he in terms of applying the knowingly standard, he put it from the point of view of the defendant, which is what they have to do. They have to prove that the police officer knew it, not that the prosecutor wants to believe it, not that anybody else believes it. He wants to put it from the standpoint of what did the defendant know. And if it looks to the defendant like the police officer were, and you've been saying this for a long time, allowed them to go in, then that's what counts. It doesn't matter. I mean, if the police officers that were sitting
well,
there in private,
isn't it entrapment? If they say come on down and then they arrest people for walking in, isn't that entrapment?
Yeah,
it's permission. Because like I say, the statute says knowingly entering a restricted area without authorization. It's authorization.
Right. Sure. And if a law enforcement authority, a law enforcement authority gives permission to a citizen to enter the Capitol building, you can't then suddenly charge them with a crime when what they did was specifically
exactly.
authorized, unless you're going to charge the officer with a crime. Ooh, there's a thought.
In other words, suppose there was a big, huge sign saying building closed.
Mm-hmm.
You may not come in. And you go to the police officer and say, look, I got to go to the bathroom really bad. Could I just slip into the restroom? Says, go ahead.
Mm-hmm.
There's a big sign saying you are on notice. You cannot come in. And the police officer says, go ahead, go to the bathroom. You know, that's lawful authorization. And,
how about a
and
traffic
here,
cop at a red
signs.
Light? How about a traffic cop at a red light? There's an accident, the red light's broken, the red light's on, or the red light's working, and the cops are there to make traffic flow better, and they wave you through. Can a cop wave you through a red light? Absolutely.
Absolutely. I was in Manhattan a few years ago, and I was not used to driving through Manhattan, and at rush hour, they wave you through. You better damn well go through the red light. The way they're acting, it's like, there's a red light, and the police officer's pointing go, you know, to clear the traffic. There wasn't an accident. It was just like clearing the rush hour traffic. It's like, and you know, you damn well better
you go.
Do what the police officer says.
Or you will have a rear ending, and don't be driving a Pinto. Anyway, I got one.
Out of curiosity, do these people have any recourse to get the year or so of their life back financially, emotionally?
If they are completely
they should be given reparations.
Yeah.
Yes. If they do not plead guilty,
$10 million apiece.
They can sue for malicious prosecution, especially
awesome.
On the grounds where the prosecutors knowingly twisted or expanded the statute from what had previously been used for. You know, the prosecutors knew that it didn't apply.
So they just have to have attorneys that would represent them in that type of court case?
Yeah.
And then how does this look for Stewart?
Well, of course, it looks good, very good. But, of course,
awesome.
He's been charged with much more serious charges as well.
Mm.
So the you know, the few have been charged with extremely serious charges, but that's a whole nother story is – Epic Times, I think, has a story. I haven't read it yet. About we filed a motion to dismiss the seditious conspiracy count, which is important because they're trying to use that to go after Trump and his inner circle. Whereas the other charges are sort of hard to stretch beyond those who were at the Capitol. The seditious conspiracy count is the easiest for them to get to spread it to everybody. And so the motion to dismiss that was just filed attacking the seditious conspiracy count is really important, and we could talk about that maybe next week.
Yeah, I got a question for you before
check
we
out
before
Epic Times.
Yeah, before we run out of time, I want to ask something we've never asked, and that is, can you, as part of the defense, go into the bank accounts or any kinds of financial records of Antifa, BLM, Ray Epps, people like that, to see if they received any compensation from the FBI, the Department of Justice, any government entity, any questionable private entity? I mean, I assume these people were paid for their activism and participation in January 6th. Can you check their financials to see if there is any kind of connection? They were paid off in some way?
Attorney Brad Geyer, who is representing Oath Keeper Kenneth Harrelson, is planning to try that. In theory, yes. In reality, the judge can quash it as being – you know, if he thinks it's going too far, and this judge probably will, but that's
the
on the plate. That's on the strategy.
Okay. Good.
So, but we're building up to that, and Brad kind of because the motion to continue to September was denied. So, you know, Brad thought and other lawyers thought they had a lot more time to build their case because you don't do something like that without building a foundation.
No, they want it before the midterm.
Getting your ducks in a row.
They don't want a Republican House and Senate, which is another story, because that'll change everything in terms of money for these, in terms of the January 6th committee. They want to get it all done way before the midterms, as much as possible. Jonathan, you got a minute.
Yeah.
We got about a minute left, and then thank you, everybody, for participating. Pianki, call earlier, please, so we can get more of your opinions. Jonathan?
Well,
Yep. Next time, I suppose, like I said, we'll go. You know, the big issue is, do we actually follow the law or not? Mm-hmm. And so far, not. And this is not. And I get really upset when I quote from judges. I quote for precedents, and judges look at me like I'm crazy. Look, I'm quoting what other judges said. I'm not mm-hmm. saying this. I'm quoting from what a judge wrote. So don't look at me. You know, I'm just quoting what the case is saying. You know, we just
well, they're
just
mad because you're using their own words against them. That's the problem.
That's the best.
Right. They don't
all
want
right.
it. You're not supposed to read the cases, Jonathan. You're supposed to be a bad lawyer and be stupid. You know, that way they can roll all over you. That's what this is all about. All right, listen. Thanks, everybody. We got about 10 seconds left. This has been fascinating. This is why. I love Thursdays. Thank you, Jonathan. Thank you, Cindy. Thank you, Pianchi. And let's do it again, certainly next Thursday. But I'll be back tomorrow morning at 6 o'clock Central, 7 Eastern, 5 Mountain, 4 Pacific. And the rest of you guys around the world, you'll figure it out.
Have a great week.